provide you with a free debt analysis and a proven plan to get you out of debt.
Trinity gave us one monthly payment we could handle.
They reduced our interest, so over time, we saved thousands.
Trinity!
Call the experts at Trinity now for your free debt analysis at 800-741-8205. 800-741-8205.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. We didn't do the show last week because of Memorial Day, so, man, like you, I've probably got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. Where'd I hear that from? Oh, yeah, it's an old Dylan song, I think. Bob Dylan, you remember him? Yeah. 313-298-WRIF is our call and phone number here. We're located in Detroit, Michigan, broadcasting primarily in the Detroit area into southern Ontario and northern Ohio. And I say that for the people listening on the internet all across the country and all across the world. In fact, where is that little thing? Maybe a time to mention it right off the bat here. That's right. Dennis is listening, and he says, I'm working at South Pole Station in Antarctica. That's right, way down where it's cold. And, you know, people try to fool your old pal Pete once in a while. So I said, can you send me some photos? Because remember, there was a guy listening in Singapore one time who did the same thing. And I don't know why I'm so suspicious of people, because the same thing happened. Like the one guy sent in these photographs from Singapore. And I know you could fake those too, but people aren't going to go to that degree just so they can say they were, their first name was mentioned on the air. Anyways, hello, Dennis, and all the rest of the people down there, way down under, right? I guess so. Or is that just apply to Australia? Well, I was going through another one of these high-anxiety preparations for this program because I told myself I got to stop copying and printing out these stories that I use on the air last week, because I wasn't going to be on the air last week, but I couldn't help it, so I didn't do like 30 or 35 like I usually do. I only did about 15 or 18, so then I did like 35 for this time. And because the evidence of the collapse of this society, I mean, come on, I mean, maybe sometimes I think I'm getting a little crazy, because I walk down the street, my wife and I, we walk our dog, we go to a movie, we hear music. Actually, we heard incredible, sort of different types. We went to the Detroit Opera Theater last night and heard this and saw this incredible performance of Salome. Richard Strauss's version of it. Originally, it was Oscar Wilde play, and this is pretty wild. You know, this is Salome does the dance of the seven veils in front of King Herod, and then wants the head of John the Baptist. Whew. Man, I can't get those images out of my mind. And this was on stage, right? It wasn't like one of these close-ups in the movies. Then we went over to the Cass Cafe to hear Canine, a band play in a benefit for. Why is that? Why is his name right out of my brain? He's been in jail for 30 years. Leonard Peltier. I'd say it either way. For the American Indian Movement, framed up in jail for 30 years. But so it was quite a spread there. Anyways, there is so much being thrown up. Man, that's a great verb phrase, isn't it? Thrown up is right. To stop us from focusing on what is really the crucial issues of the day. It's not immigration. I'm not trying to say it's not a problem, but that's not our major, the big problem confronting us. First National Guard troops are being sent down to assist the immigration agents, and they're working on projects near a fortified stretch of desert along the U.S.-Mexico border. Bet this does nothing. Absolutely nothing. The problem isn't going to be solved by big walls or whatever. I mean, because think about this. Say they put in this huge wall, spending billions of more of our dollars, giving it to Bush's contractor friends, because that's what's going to happen. But the people that are here are still here, right? They won't be able to get back either. That's another thing. You're walling them in. You're walling new people out, walling the people that are here in. So until this continent comes to grips with the disparity of income and wealth, this is going to be continue to be a problem. And when police enforcement, however you want to define it in terms of larger or smaller scale activities, whether it's in a town or whether it's nationally, when you have, when you've come to the point where you have to have overwhelming force in order to create some degree of stability, or at least think you will, you probably won't get it. I mean, if you think about, quote, crime-ridden cities, usually, like when New York was crime-ridden, they had, what was it? Did they have like, 20,000 police, maybe more. That's, I don't want, always lowball. But in other words, they had an incredible number of police. They were sending people to jail for incredibly long sentences. Cops were really brutal, and crime continued. That's not what sent crime down. Anyways, other things, like Iran is really not a problem, but it's being elevated by the Bush administration, Bushco, Bush Incorporated, Bush and Sons Incorporated, into a major problem. But it's not a problem. Iran does not represent a threat to us. Iran does not represent a threat in the Middle East. This is very similar, as you can imagine, by the use of the language, to what was happening in Iraq. And again, it's always the United States, and in both cases, Bush, Iraq, and Iran, that's defining this as a problem. This is a country, our country, that is 6,000 miles away. You don't hear anyone else screaming. Every once in a while, the president of Iran starts making nasty noises about Israel, and Israel doesn't start a big commotion about it. It doesn't start saying we've got to do this and we've got to do that or there's going to be trouble. It's the United States. It's the United States that's 6,000 miles from home, killing people, having its soldiers being killed. And you know how many U.S. casualties there are now? We ought to talk about what's happening over there because that is one of the big problems, both with this, these new revelations about the killing of civilians. Hey, there's already been over 100,000 civilians killed. And whether they were killed in the manner of Hodeitha or just, hey, let's just bomb the joint, what's the difference? Still winds up with dead civilians. And why was the United States there in the first place? If you're really kind, which I'm not, and not most Americans aren't, Bush made a catastrophic strategic error in thinking that there were weapons of mass destruction. Myself and probably at least half the population thinks he just out and out lied in order to create the war that they've wanted, he and his conservative buddies wanted since the 1990s. And this is exactly what they're doing again, although it's not clear to me whether or not there's going to be a war, but we can get to that in just a minute. I think I'm going to sneeze. I've never done that on the air before. All right, let's look at it this way. Your comments always welcome. 313-298-WRIF. If you want to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Oh, yeah, I forgot to say ITMFA, too. If you don't know what that means, you can go to ITMFA.com. ITMFA.com. And it has rude language there. I'll let you guess what the F stands for. So if you don't like to see that stuff, don't go there. You go to my website as well. You can link to it from there. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. PeterWerbe.com. All right. So, oh, yeah. One of these other smoke screens being thrown up literally in our face is this whole idea about a constitutional amendment that would define marriage as being exclusively between a man and the woman. Now, this has no chance of passing. The Bush knows that, the conservatives know that, the Republicans know that, but it's just more smoke and mirrors, so we don't focus on the economy, we don't focus on the war. And if I understand, somebody tell me, if I have a misunderstanding of the United States Constitution, that it is a political document which defines the administrative operations of the government which rules us. It sets out what the government can do and can't do. It had a number of amendments to deal with that. It, and it's also about ownership of property. Some property cannot be owned. Human beings, for instance. Remember, the United States began as a slave state and a nation that allowed the slave trade to occur. So in the document itself, the slave trade is abolished by 1803. In other words, you cannot bring in slaves, human chattel, any longer after 1803. Did end. And then, of course, it took this violent civil war that I think, if but my memory's right, took the lives of about 400,000 Americans to tell the South, hey, no, you cannot have slaves. And then so there's a constitutional amendment against that. But this has no part in it whatsoever. It's simply a political ploy. And it is absolutely repulsive to tell 20, 30, 40 million American people that you're less than human and to install it in the foundation document of the United States of America. It's bad enough it's in enough state constitutions. But, I've rarely ever heard more than like a minute and a half of George W. Bush ever since he was the governor of Texas. I mean, I can't tolerate the sound of his voice. There's no need for me to listen to it because you can always read this and then you can dissect it. I mean, I know he makes so many gaffes that it's funny to listen to, and I've heard those, but still, they're pretty short. I was trapped in Royal Oak. That's right. I was going to the Royal Oak Farmers Market. Just to get some vegetables and stuff. And they had this big race there. So I got trapped. It was like 10 a.m. So I started listening to Bush's talk, his weekly talk. And so he was calling for an amendment to ban same-sex marriages. I almost drove off the road. The vileness of what he said, the duplicity, the prejudicial basis of it all. Essentially, he said the majority of people don't like the idea of gay marriage, so we should inscribe it in our Constitution. Well, people didn't a long time ago, didn't like whites and blacks marrying, and that was laws in lots of states. In Germany, only white Gentiles white Gentiles could marry. So political states do ban certain people from joining together as legal marriages, but it doesn't have a very pretty history. And neither do these right-wingers. And you start seeing the fascistic elements to it when they start playing to the worst and most base emotions. I went to a wonderful memorial for a gay man today. He's 84 years old. His partner was there. Of course, they could never be legal. They were only together for, I don't know, years and years and years and years and years. But George Bush wants to make sure that people aren't going to recognize them as a marriage, as two people really committed to one another, like all of us who knew the man knew that they were. Well, anyways, actually I've talked about this, haven't I? Here, if someone can tell me why men should not marry men and women should not marry women, and don't give me any religious reasons, because this is a secular state and we are not going to start putting religious stuff in the Constitution. That ain't going to happen. Well, it's not going to happen if this is still going to be America. Remember, I've said so many times before, the Founding Fathers did not want to have religion and the political state conjoined. And I put this away. I will reach it again. If I have to read it 40 times, I will. The First Amendments, when they realized, well, wait a minute, we haven't guaranteed a lot of things here. The first thing that Congress guaranteed, actually, maybe that's even the wrong word, because they didn't guarantee anything in the First Amendment in the first clause. They said Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. They didn't give us the right of free speech or of the press or anything like that. The thing that they were the most worried about was that there would be an establishment of religion. And you don't have, although some of these nuts out there would like that, to make like this their brand of Christianity. And certainly they don't want to make my friend's brand of Christianity the official religion. They want to make their fascistic, right-wing, conservative, fundamentalist Christianity the official religion of this country. But you can't have religious-based arguments for a secular political document in a secular political country. All right, so what someone has to say is there is some harm that comes from men marrying men or women marrying women. Right? Well, if anybody can think of it, please tell me. 313-298-WRIF. A lot of conservatives, by the way. I mean, maybe we should call these people like Bush and them fascists and right-wingers, because conservatives are concerned that this is transferring power, states regulate marriage, to the federal government. And they're a little shaky about this. And thank you. I mean, when you find some people with some integrity on the right wing side of things, it's pretty unusual. So it's a lot of nonsense. People, I mean, what do you care? You say, you know, I don't like the idea of men marrying men. Well, so what? It's none of your business. Absolutely none of your business. Everything going all right in your life? Well, maybe then you have some time left over to start checking out other people's lives, but maybe you could do it charitably and compassionately and help some less fortunate people. Don't start mucking in other people's love lives. None of your damn business. What people do and whether you like it or not is not an issue. In fact, don't like it. Who cares? But don't make your problem with it other people's problem. That's what I'm saying. So has anybody got some idea why here? I'm a married man, as they say. Been married for a long time. Been married to the same woman. Never, my one and only wife. And you know, a lot of people have problems with marriage. I'm not disparaging anybody who's had a one or two or three marriages. I know some people that have had three. And yet, when maybe we should actually, given how much trouble heterosexual marriages are, maybe we should ban those. Give the gays a shot at it. Actually, let me see, when will we do it? At 1, we'll do it at 1 a.m. 1 a.m. Eastern Time. I have a book called Gay Marriages, What We Have Learned. And it's an author who went to Denmark, where gay marriages have been legal since 1989. And, of course, everything has gone to hell. Of course not. Nothing has. In fact... marriages are up in general. People stay together longer. Illegitimate births are down. And so this causal thing that some of these nutball conservatives try to put forth, because they don't want to sound the kind of intolerant and prejudicial people they really are, they've got these cockamamie connections between things. Well, the only place there's evidence, it's gone the other way, right? So, 1 a.m. for that. All right. I was going into work today, and I passed our neighborhood Citgo gas station, the only place to buy, because that's the one place where the profits go to the people and not to the rich corporate owners. It's owned by the nation of Venezuela, and the profits go to help the real, real poor people of the hemisphere. That's where I buy all my gas. I would urge you to do the same. Anyways, their prices are no different than anyone else's. And, I mean, actually, they're always the lowest of the people that are the lowest, because, you know, they were like $4 and some other places $2.89. I'm not going to pay $4. Any event, $2.89. I'm thinking, wow, well, we sure not talking about that anymore. We're talking about gay marriage. We're talking about Iran. We're talking about immigrants. But the fact that we're getting screwed at every turn, that drops off of the, off the agenda. Well, it doesn't with me, but most of us think we're getting screwed at the gas pump. I mean, don't you? I mean, when you hear about Lee Raymond, the retiring CEO of ExxonMobil, getting a $400 million retirement package, don't you think you paid for that and I paid for that? Well, of course we did. There is so much excess profit in this profit-swollen, gouging corporation that they can afford to give that guy that. And I'm sort of repeating things, because when I was in Caracas and saw the level of poverty, even with all the help that's being given by the government, it's pretty shocking. And so $400 million going into health care and education and food and hopefully eventually housing for the poor of Caracas, of which there's millions of poor people in one city. So we all think we're getting screwed, right? Or most people. However, we're wrong. We're absolutely wrong. Despite suspicions, this is from the May 22nd. You see, I've been holding this for a while. May 23rd, New York Times. Despite suspicion among consumers about rapidly rising gasoline prices and record oil industry profits, a federal investigation concluded Monday that the jump at the pump over the last year had not been the result of unlawful price manipulation. The commission said this evidence collected in this investigation indicated the firms behaved competitively. In other words, they moved up the price when they could. But it doesn't make any sense. I've talked about this a lot, about if the price just went up and they maintained the same profit levels, they wouldn't be making record profits. How could they make record profits and not be gouging us? It doesn't make a bit of sense. Now, There's a lot of people making out okay on this, including some, of course, the big oil giants that are all Bush's friends and give him and the Republican Party millions and millions of dollars to continue to allow this. But also all the oil producers are doing real well, including Venezuela, including Saudi Arabia, including Iran. Iran's making a fortune. Venezuela's making a fortune. Hugo Chavez, the president, says oil ought to be $50. Right now, that oil has climbed a dollar over the last couple of days. So now it's $73 on Iran worries. Oil prices climbed over a dollar to above 73 on Monday. It's already Monday in the Middle East. After Iran hinted it might use oil production as a weapon in its nuclear dispute with the West, and hitches at U.S. refineries spurred worries over fuel supplies. I didn't read that real clearly, but the prices are going up. So you're going to be paying more. We'll be paying more. We'll probably be paying $3. $2.89, and we go, oh, well, what the hell, $2.89, who cares? Well, most of us do, but we have lost that kind of indignation that we first had. Now, how much is this being manipulated purposely by the United States to have their cake and eat it too? This dispute with Iran is pure BS. I'll say it again. Iran does not represent a threat to the United States, for sure. It is perfectly okay within the terms of the non-proliferation treaty for Iraq to refine high-grade nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. The UN Security Council reaffirmed Iran's right to do that. The International Atomic Energy Agency has consistently said there is no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program or is diverting nuclear material from its research. This is all speculation, because it's the same process. When you're creating this fuel for reactors, you can use it to power a power plant, like we have down at Fermi 2, let's cross our fingers, or you could divert part of it and use it for nuclear weapons. Now, Iran says they're not doing that. There's no evidence that they are doing this. It means that they have the capacity to do this sometime way in the future. Now, no one should have nuclear weapons at all. So if we begin in that part of the world, we then go to the one power that has it, and that's Israel. They should not have nuclear weapons. They are not a member of any treaty. They will not affirm or deny even whether they have any nuclear weapons. Everyone in the world does. And then you begin to go across the world and say, India should not have nuclear weapons. Pakistan. I mean, can you imagine Pakistan, that is always just a hair's breadth away from the government being seized by the Osama bin Laden types and having nuclear weapons? Russia should not have them. The United States should not have them. China shouldn't. And is there any attempt whatsoever at complete and full nuclear disarmament? No. Bush, in fact, has violated its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty by developing a new regime of so-called bunker-busting, low-yield nuclear weapons. This is forbidden. So Bush, the outlaw, which has driven the United States into being an outlaw regime on everything from preemptive wars to torture and who knows how many other things. Now, on this, might makes right. Might makes right. Nobody should have nuclear power either. There's absolutely nowhere to put this waste anywhere in the world. I don't know where the hell the Europeans are putting it, or where people in other parts of the world are. But this is, I've been holding this from March. Progress towards opening a nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. That's where they want to put all this. Everybody in Nevada, Republican and Democrats, are completely against it. And this means that they would have to truck highly radioactive nuclear waste from Fermi 2, which is about, 45, 50 miles south of here, from where we're broadcasting in Detroit, and ship it across the United States. And all these nuclear power plants would have to do the same thing, and it would all go in one place, and then it would have to hang safely for a quarter of a million years. Now, what do they think? Humans first appeared on the planet how many years ago? I mean, it was only 40,000 years ago. I think they got it up to 100,000. So this is 2.5 times the length of of our existence on the planet. This stuff has to be kept safe. Safe. It can't leak. And that's what they're worried about, Yucca Mountain. It can't be on a earthquake fault. It is. And we continue processing this stuff and letting it hang out down in Monroe, Michigan, which, sorry, Monroeans, but is also the birthplace of George Custer. You know, that doesn't, never has made me, now the symbolism has always made me feel a little queasy. Anyways, progress towards opening a nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain in Nevada remains hindered by questions about the quality of scientific and engineering work a year after accusations of fraud emerged. More just absolute thorough corruption in this system at everywhere you look. Congressional investigators said among the problems cited in a report by the Government Accountability Office was a high turnover of project managers. Oh, that's good. 9 of the 17 key management positions have turned over since 2001, and the director of quality assurance was among them. This is really bad. The report said the Energy Department's reorganization of the project had not put problems to rest and could delay the filling of an application by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a license to open the dump, which was approved by Congress in 2002 to store 77,000 tons of radioactive nuclear waste. More than 50,000 tons of waste is waiting at 72 sites. So Iran should not have peaceful nuclear power. The United States should not have nuclear power. But this could be what Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and Bush are planning to stop what is going to be a catastrophic electoral loss for the Republicans in November. They know they have to do something. They won the 2002 elections by playing the Iraq card. There was no threat from Iraq. They knew it, but they said now's the time because everyone will get behind Bush. And they did. And rather than the Republicans losing handily like they were on their way to doing, they won even a larger majority. Bush's popularity went from, I don't know what it was then, about 45% or something up to about 70% because he was leading the charge against the terrorists in Iraq. Well, that all turned out to be 100% BS, not 98% or 99%, but 100%. And will they try the same thing here? Now, here is what is really scary. There's reports from all over the world, by the way. This from the UK Herald, United Kingdom, reported 2 weeks ago that in the article called U.S. Spells Out Plans to Bomb Iran, that, quote, the U.S. is updating contingency plans for a strike to cripple Iran's atomic weapon program if international diplomacy fails. The plan calls for a rolling five-day bombing campaign against 400 key targets, including 24 nuclear-related sites, 14 military airfields and radar installations, and Revolutionary Guard headquarters. Well, won't that be fun? So the United States will kill thousands and thousands of people. And how is that going to go down in the Middle East? Many of the Shiites are ostensible allies over there in Iraq, are connected directly to the religious leaders of Iran and have promised to attack U.S. forces if Iran is attacked. But maybe they think, you know, they're the masters of chaos. I mean, they create chaos everywhere they go. Iraq, Katrina, you know, you name it. And, well, what about those Iranians? Aren't they just really, really crazy? And aren't they going to just want war? And if they get these nuclear weapons, even if they're 5 or 10 years away from them? Well, in a recent article by Gareth Porter that was in the International Press Service, Iran proposal to the U.S. offered peace with Israel. You heard it. The author reports that in 2003, Iran not only offered to, quote, accept peace with Israel and cut off material assistance to Palestinian armed groups, but made a, quote, two-page proposal for a broad U.S.-Iran agreement covering all issues facing the two countries, close quote. The secret document that was provided to the IPS proves that Iran is rather neither committed to the destruction of Israel nor to the continued sponsorship of terrorist groups. What they want is a non-aggression treaty with the United States. They want a promise that the United States will not invade them. There's two ways to do it. One is to have nuclear weapons, and then the United States would not do it, or to have a non-aggression pact. They would promise not to attack anyone, including the United States, and the United States would have to agree not to invade Iran. Well, they ain't going to do it because the insane neocons, these conservatives that mucked everything up with Iraq, are on the move again, and they are creating the basis for at least a contingency plan of the bombing of Iran. Well, all hell will break loose if that happens. But these people are mad. They are absolutely quite mad. And there has to be motion towards stopping them. The press, compliant as usual, even in this language. Where is this here? Iran's atomic weapons program. There's not even any proof that they have an atomic weapons program. All right, we're going to take a break, and I'll get your calls, so I appreciate your patience. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising, and promotional agencies and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Hey, thank you very much and welcome back. I'm queer-loving Peter Werby. It is just someone called up and was just screaming, I guess, at our phone screener, Norma. Hey, you know, I am here. You know, don't unload on her. Talk to me. Am I queer-loving? You're damn right I am, because I love everybody that doesn't hurt other people. So I don't love this guy. I don't love this guy because he tried to hurt people with his words. But and by the way, there are a number of gay people that do call themselves queer, so it's not like the N-word. But remember, they used to say that in the South. You're an N-lover, like that. And I'd say, damn right I am. You hate him, I love him. And obviously, within those categories, rather than seeing as individuals that all decent people see everyone, don't care the color of their skin or their sexual preference or anything like that. That's just background. That's just background. It's bigots, like the person called, that brings it to the fore, because skin color really doesn't matter. Sexual preference really doesn't matter. Gender really doesn't matter. And just the terribly twisted people, the twistoids of our society that have these awful attitudes that make life worse. Think how hard life always is, as it is, even in the best of societies without jerks like this making it even worse. You know, I was remiss. I meant to announce this right at the beginning, and here this beautiful picture staring me right in the face, my old pal and co-producer, Jolene Jordan. Many of you remember her from being a disc jockey, a rock and roll DJ here on WRIF, and some of you who listened to Jolene and me on the now-defunct IE America Radio Network, where she and I did a syndicated show together, remember her. Yeah. Well, Jolene's been doing a lot of things since she and I, since the network went belly up. And one of the things she's done is to put out this incredibly beautiful new album. And, she's going to have a CD release party coming up this Wednesday, June 7th at Club Bart in Ferndale. That's right across from the Ferndale Post Office, 9 Mile and Woodward on the east side of the street, Club Bart. And joining her are going to be some of the members of Sponge, like Vinny Dombrowski, the Vinny of Sponge. And I actually would just play a little bit of this one that I like a lot, and I'm sure she's going to sing on Wednesday. So this is Jolene Jordan. You go to Jolene. It's J-U-L-I-N-E. J-U-L-I-N-E. Jolene Jordan, the new CD is What She Said. Join us up at Club Bart this Wednesday, June 7th at 9 p.m. And then the Orbisons, another one of Vinny's projects, going to go on stage after that. So this is Jolene. I hope I get the honor of doing the radio premiere of Jolene's song. Here it is. Jolene Jordan on WRIF, the Night Call Show, my old partner, and from her brand new album, What She Said. It's you can take a look at it at Jolene, J-U-L-I-N-E, JoleneJordan.com. And if you go to my website and then go to the calendar page, you can hear this, like, for instance, this full song that I unceremoniously cut off. But, hey, we're a talk show, right? Baghdad and Beyond, it's done with Vinny of Sponge, who will be at the CD release party, and that'll be this Wednesday, June 7th, Club Bart in Ferndale, just south of 9 Mile Road, right across the street from the Ferndale City Hall. And all of this music is really happening. For the third time in their career, the Dixie Chicks are on top of the Billboard 200. That's everything. So they're outselling everybody. They got their brand new album, Taking the Long Way, and selling first week 500,000 copies. And also, it is number one in the country album charts as well, bumping out Rascal Flatts, me and my gang. Don't know him. I've been listening to a little country music. Man, those people are always whining. I mean, it's music based on whining, but not the Dixie Chicks. And, you know, here's the difference. When the Dixie Chicks said they were ashamed that Bush was born in Texas, I mean, I was ashamed he was born in the world, they were ostracized by country radio and the country community. In fact, they said they no longer think of themselves as part of the country community, but rather part of the rock community. And it shows you the totalitarian streak that these people have. And I use the word purposely. They want to totalize their view. Anybody that doesn't toe the party line. You know, and so this is, like in Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, you're the enemy. So think about somebody like Ted Nugent, who, when people ask me, what do I think about Ted Nugent? I say, he plays good guitar. But his politics are terrible. Didn't he move down to Crawford, Texas to be near Bush? And he's this nutball NRA spokesman who wants to take over from, what was the guy? Charlton Heston, if he hasn't already, or something like that. But everyone in the rock community knows that he's one of the few right wingers that plays rock music. But we don't call up and say, hey, WRIF, why are you paying Fred Bear or Cat Scratch Fever or Wang Dang Doodle or something like that? Get him off. We don't want him on. He doesn't have our opinions. We don't do that. We listen to the man play his music. All right. One of the other things, we're talking about Iran, it's another phony crisis, but one that could be made real. Why does the United States have any right to dictate what goes on 6,000 miles from our home when we haven't even dealt with the massive problems that we have here? And also the smoke screens that are being put up, Iran being one of them, but could become real. But a real smoke screen is this whole thing about gay marriage. And I asked people to call up if they could tell me what is wrong with gay marriage. How is it hurting anyone? Religious excuses don't fly. As far as I'm concerned, this is a secular government. He is trying to infuse, as he has violated the Constitution, he being Bush, so many times, inserting religion into a secular document that rules a secular country. Even if people are more religious here than most places where, you know, people like us live. All right, let's start off with Kevin in Royal Oak. Kevin, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hello?
Yeah, Kevin, turn your radio off, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, what's up?
Turn the radio off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kevin, talk to me. Yeah. Kevin, can you figure this out quickly?
It's off.
Okay, talk to me. You're on the air.
All right. Actually, I was calling about something you were talking about way earlier.
What's that?
The gay marriage.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
And the government.
Yeah.
First of all, government interference, the first sign of it is not the gay marriage. It goes all the way back to the In God We Trust on the money.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that came along way before the religious implements on anything else. But also, yeah, I'm not gay. I don't think, honestly, in my opinion, I don't think being gay is right scientifically.
Scientifically?
Scientifically, yeah. Because any animal that there is, and the species as a whole, the purpose of the species is to regenerate and populate the species, you know?
Did you know, you don't know about this. You've never done a lot of research in biology, have you? Because actually animals express gay behavior, and one of the things that they tend to do is when there's overpopulation. Hello, mallard ducks, you know, those ducks we see everywhere with a lot of green on it. When there's not a, you know, a lot of enough females to go around, the males hang out and they're called bachelor buddies. I don't think they have sex.
Right. Gay ducks.
I don't know. I mean, what the hell? It's up to...
Yeah, like, I don't think, you know...
But anyways, we got enough people producing. I haven't produced anything. What's the difference between my wife and I and a gay couple?
It doesn't... from a scientific standpoint,
yeah,
it doesn't do anything for the species.
Well, so what? I mean, don't you think we got a few too many people on the planet that's part of our problem, that we're going up towards 6 billion people, and we're going to put our lawn chairs everywhere that once was nature? I mean, hey, if you're saying that an objection to gays is that they don't reproduce. I would say that's one of the valuable things. But anyways, we're not talking about their sexual preferences that they have. We're talking about it being part of the United States Constitution. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Here is Mohammed in Dearborn. Mohammed, hi. You're on Night Call. It's Peter Werby with you.
Hey, Peter. How's it going, my man?
Going great.
All right. Well, I'm not really calling. The guy that you had earlier sounds a little bit like a clown. But I'm trying to actually do the gay defense, the whole gay amendment thing, to the gay man's defense. You put it this way. How many gay guys out there pretty much have been putting off marrying their partner because it's not a law? It's the perfect cop-out for the gay dude, the gay bachelor. You know? So That's how I feel.
Okay, Mohammed, thank you. I don't get that, but we'll leave it at that. Maybe somebody else can as well. Uh-oh. We've got somebody from Monroe that wants to defend my slander of it, but we can go to that. Let's go to Rich is in Boulder, Colorado. Rich, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
Calling to talk about a book I'm reading right now. It's called Earth and Mind by David Orr.
Okay.
David Orr is a professor down at Oberlin College down in Indiana. And the book...
Ohio.
Yes. Or is it Ohio?
Yeah.
And the book basically starts off with the premise that our education system is geared towards basically a paradigm to destroy the planet and the ecosystem, which I can really agree with. And, you know, we're pushing growth markets and all this kind of thing. But he also goes on beyond that and talking about transforming our education system and how we can do that with an ecological perspective. And the importance of that going across disciplines, you know, from economics to physics to art to marketing, all having some kind of ecological understanding in all of those things.
Uh-huh.
You know, exponential growth in all those different fields means something different. But in ecology, when you have exponential growth, you usually have some kind of crash. And we're seeing that in population growth of humans right now.
Sure.
And so it's a serious problem. And we have people all over the place, you know, consuming more and more, and there's more and more of us, and China coming into the oil scene more and more, with more Chinese people getting single occupancy vehicles and whatnot. And so the warning flags are there in terms of what's happening to the ecology, with the coral reefs going away, the rainforest.
That's scary. I'm going to be interviewing at 1:30 a.m. Eastern, so that's, what, 11:30 your time, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to interview Derek Jensen, who has a new 2-volume book out called Endgame. Kind of scary. He's got 2 volumes. First one's very scary. It's called Problems with Civilization, that talks about how that essentially all of civilization, even when it was small, when the first cities, it was really stealing from... that's not nice. Stealing from Peter to pay Paul. And because cities got to a point where they weren't self-sustaining, so they had to deplete resources from another area, which then, of course, had to deplete resources from another area. Well, now that it's worldwide, this system of what we call civilization, a lot of things are beginning to crash in. But he has a second volume. It's called Resistance. So, fortunately, he sees a little bit of hope, but we've got to change our ways.
Well, Orr writes about ecophobia, people being afraid of nature, and, you know, people who've grown up in cities are afraid to go camping for a weekend, afraid of the bears and whatnot, and that's really a scary place to be, in that, you know, if a person's never been in a forest, how can they make that connection when the forest is gone and not understanding the basics of, like, the hydrological cycle and things like that? You know, that's very important.
Well, I mean, people, we've been city dwellers for a long time, and I don't think you have to go camping to understand that if the ice caps are starting to melt, we've got a serious problem. All right, thanks for calling all the way from Boulder, Rich. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. I'm interested in this. Here's Tim in Detroit. Tim, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Pete?
Doing good. What's up?
Well, I don't know what that guy's scientific claims are. I have it on pretty good authority. I actually wasn't there. But there's this old coffee house around here in Detroit. It's called Zoot. Now it's closed down. But years ago, a lot of the witnesses had seen a couple of male dogs doing it. And both owners were there, and I mean, they were going at it like
a... Wait a minute there. I don't know if I want to go there.
Well, I mean...
Let me say this to you, Tim, that homosexual behavior in animals is well documented.
Yeah, as well as in our species, sex and all
and
that.
And it's also completely natural. I mean, people say it's not natural. There is, of course, the tendency towards the propagation of the species. That's why we have a sexual drive.
Sure.
But the fact that homosexuality is a universal activity in every society that's ever existed, and every society, no matter how much they've tried to eradicate it, whether it's like punishment by death or torture, it still goes on. So it's natural, and if people don't like it, here's my advice for them. Don't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think people ought to just be cool with it.
I think so. All right, Tim, thank you very much. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. I may have to apologize after this call, but let's get Paul from Monroe. And, Paul, do I have to apologize?
No, you don't have to apologize.
Okay.
Not at all. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Oh, wow. Just wanted to comment about Monroe a little bit.
Sure.
I've got a friend of mine who's going through some difficulties in the court system right now because he's getting railroaded, which is not uncommon in this part. You have too many cops per capita, if you know what I mean. And it just seems like things don't flow the same way in Monroe County that it does in other parts of the state.
Yeah, well, maybe it's the Custer legacy or something.
Yeah, it might be. Because, I mean, I work in Woodhaven, I work in Trenton, I work in Southgate, and I see the rest of the state, and the rest of the state just does not seem like it functions the same way it does in Monroe.
Well, you know what? I somehow think, Paul, that other people, the grass is always greener.
Yeah, well.
That could be it. All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your comments. Actually, I was at, I told this story just a little while ago. I spoke in Monroe maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I said, it's a pleasure to be here in Monroe, the home of General George Custer and Fermi II. And I crossed my fingers, like, for good luck, and, like, half the audience booed. That was weird. All right. Here's Steve. Steve's in Royal Oak. Steve, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing great.
Just wanted to make a couple comments here about your feelings about George W. Bush.
Yeah.
How you feel shame that you're from the same country.
Planet.
Planet.
Yeah.
I just can't understand that. I mean, don't you feel safer that Saddam Hussein is no longer in power? Don't you feel safer as an American knowing he's protecting our freedoms and the terrorists from us?
This is a joke call, right?
This is 100% serious.
I always appreciate the right of a minority to dissent. I mean, you people holding your view is probably down to under 30% now. No, of course, he's made us much less safe. He's created the context in which 20,000 American casualties have occurred, right?
Uh-huh. 20,000 American. How many deaths were occurred, murders in Detroit last year?
Well, I don't know, a few hundred, not 2,500 like we're going.
Oh.
But see, actually, what's happened? I think people universally see, Steve, that the idea that was put forth by Bush and these other liars that said that that there were weapons of mass destruction or said that there was any connection whatsoever with 9-1-1, thought that they were, you know, they, when the liars lie to themselves, they can tell themselves we're going to be welcomed as liberators. We're going to be run out of there with 20,000 casualties and having spent hundreds of billions of dollars that have gone down the drain to Cheney's firm and to these contractors that can't even accomplish the most simple things imaginable. It is one of the worst foreign policy disasters in American history.
Mm-hmm. And you're in Detroit. You're not in Washington, or you're not overseas. You're not in the Middle East at all.
Yeah, you're right. I'm here
no
in Detroit.
Things.
Yeah. You get an A in geography. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Craig. Craig's in Auburn Hills. Craig, hi.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You're on the air. Hey, Craig.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great, Craig. Craig, you got to turn off your radio.
It's off.
Go ahead. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. You don't sound like Peter.
Well, I'm doing the best I can.
All right. Hey, I want to talk to you about your comments about the oil earlier.
Sure.
About how the oil companies are making record profits and whatnot.
Right.
Well, you know what? You know, that means the government's making record profits.
Taxes.
Hello?
Yeah, right. The taxes, right?
Well, yeah, this isn't Peter.
And this isn't Craig. We got to go, buddy. See ya. Who could it be? Who did he think it would be? I was looking for some letter I got or some message. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Maybe clear the decks a little here, do some commercials, and we'll be right back with the second hour of Night Call on WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. We have a town around here out near Pinckney, Michigan. If you're listening in some other part of the country on the internet, it's called Hell, Hell, Michigan. In fact, I was going to put together a bicycle ride from Hell to Bliss. Bliss, Michigan is up a ways. Anyways, and, anyways. And someone wrote me and said, don't say anyways, it's anyway. Okay. But I don't even want to say either of those words. But on Tuesday, it's going to be June 6, 2006, which is 666, right? And they're planning a hot time in Hell, Michigan on Tuesday. The day it bears the date of 6606, or abbreviated as 666, a number that carries hellish significance. And they're going to be whooping it up at the Dam Site Inn, which is a little bar there. We used to ride from Ann Arbor. These are on bicycles now, not on motorcycles, and go there, have a beer, and then ride back and go to, what is it, Argilio's, something like that. Good Italian restaurant, little place near the farmer's market there in Ann Arbor. So the 6-6 revelry is just the latest chapter in the town's storied history of publicity stunts, said Jason Lateff, one of its 72 year-round residents, or as the mayor calls them, hellions or hellbillies. But Lateff wasn't particularly enthused. He said, now here I am living in hell, taking my kids to church and trying to teach them the right things, and the town where we live is having a 666 party. There you go. Well, one of the scams that is going on about Iran, so let me say it again if you're just joining us. Iran represents no threat to the United States. It represents no threat to the region. And the best thing the United States could do would be to initiate a non-aggression treaty, which they will not do because they want to act unilaterally in the world. They do not want to give credence to the fact that maybe the United States would have to submit to binding agreements. Now, one of the reasons, too, I mean, you ever think, why are these Iranians so crazy? Why do they hate us so much? Why did they, if we go way back in ancient history in 1979, why did they invade our embassy and hold these people hostage and burn our flags? And they're nasty. Well, first off, why are we over there in their face in the first place? We don't live over there. They don't represent a threat to us. But beyond that, the United States and Britain has been involved negatively in the affairs of Iran for so long, including, this is the United States now, overthrowing a democratically elected government in Iran via the CIA in 1953. Overthrew a democratically elected government because, guess what? Guess what the president of Iran, the elected president of Iran, a secular man, not a Muslim, was trying to do? He's trying to nationalize the Iranian oil because, of course, it was owned by American and British firms. So the CIA and British intelligence couldn't allow that, couldn't allow the Iranians to control their own oil. So they simply overthrew the government, put in this torture state run by this Shah. And when he was finally overthrown, guess what? Guess what? The Iranian people hate us. And they know that date in 1953. I don't know what the date is, but they do. It's etched in all their memories. So that's a case of chickens coming home to roost. Now, the predecessors of these evil morons that are currently running things, they know that history, but they really don't care because they suffer no consequences. And their rich class of rulers, in whose benefit they make decisions, they benefit all the time. Well, so what? You know, we get kicked out of Iraq. We have 20,000 casualties. The Marines now are so over the edge that they're slaughtering Iraqi civilians. And some of them, though, they're saying it's okay. You know, that they found some of them guilty. That it was okay that these folks got killed by legitimate means. That women and children were killed not by shooting them in the head, where apparently they were at this in this other town, but just through the normal means of warfare. That's okay. To me, it doesn't matter one way or the other. There's no reason for the United States to be carrying on warfare in Iraq, and whether there is this horrid massacres that have occurred. And hey, it's going down. Remember in Vietnam, the United States troops were killing like 500 at a crack, like at places like My Lai. So if it's down to two dozen, like apparently there's been some progress. But I don't mean to be entirely facetious about something this awful, because the consequences also bear on us, who are the perpetrator nation, and the young men who go out and commit crimes like that. Well, when you fight a whole population, when the whole population wants you out of there, except for the people that you're paying and are ripping us off for billions of dollars, and you can't tell who's who and who's your friend during the day and who's the enemy at night, and you've seen your buddies killed, you've seen your buddies wounded, you fear for your own life, you don't want to be there, but you can do some pretty awful things. And that's not to excuse it. There's a difference between explanation and excuses. And ultimately, it all goes back to the people that started this on the basis, again, if you're kind, on a mistake. And I don't think there's too many of us that are that kind, or on the basis of lies, and now don't know how the hell to get out. I'm sure that they have all sorts of contingency plans of getting out. 1972, in the Iraq War, where people listening, father and grandfathers, were over fighting, getting killed by the hundreds every week, torching villages, killing villagers. There was a saying over there, kill them all, let God sort them out. Henry Kissinger was in China in 1972 telling the premier, Zhou Enlai, we really don't care if Vietnam goes communist. We really don't care. And he said, we just need a little bit of interval. I forgot there's a phrase. I don't know if I can find this quickly enough, the report of it. He says, we just need a big enough interval so that we don't, here at home, we don't look terrible. In the meantime, this death and destruction is going on both sides, where these people responsible for it all, in this case, Kissinger and Nixon, are saying, hey, what the hell? So believe it, at some level in there, the only thing that is being discussed is how can we get out of there without creating losses for the Republican Party? How can we get out of there now that we've spent this enormous amount of, or shed this enormous amount of human blood on both sides, primarily on the Iraqi side, like always? The other side gets damaged much, much worse. The country's destroyed. It's run by insurgents and criminal gangs. No one's safe. The middle class is leaving. $48 billion have been expended on reconstruction packages that have been a total failure. Not for the companies that are getting paid and the Iraqis that have made off with the money. They did fine. I mean, we financed all this. Instead of our schools, our medical program, our infrastructure, our country being made better from what we've earned, we turned it over to these people. And what does Steve from Royal Oak say? Don't you feel safer? Yikes. All right. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Devon in Detroit. Hey, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hello? Why are we having so much trouble with these phones tonight? Try it again, Devon. You hung up on yourself. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Chris. Chris is in Farmington Hills. Hey, Chris, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, Peter. How's it going?
Going good. Thanks for calling.
I want to start out. I think you're a damn necessary voice out here in Detroit. I just came back visiting family out from California.
Yeah.
And it was good to hear your voice on the air on my drive out to KZU to visit my brother. But anyways, I wanted to get to the, you were talking about gay marriage issue, and I remember talking with friends and family about it the first time all that came around. And the idea that I've always had is that this shouldn't be an issue, because to me, in the basic notion of a democracy, it's majority rule, but the main point in our system is with minority protection.
Sure.
You can't just say majority rules. You have to, you know, watch out for the little guy that doesn't have the voice that also has rights too, other, you know, deep philosophical rights to be a human and to live. And so to me, when basic laws, important laws come about, they should be about protecting people. And the protection is the key word, not about enforcing someone else's desire upon somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Bush's whole talk on Saturday saying he was going to support this amendment to the United States Constitution to ban gay marriage was talking about the majority of people agreed with this. And I was thinking, what about Board versus Brown versus Board of Education? that outlawed segregation in schools in 1954. Certainly the directly affected school, the southern schools, if you would have taken a vote among the people, particularly among the white people, they would have overwhelmingly said that they supported the continuing segregation. And they said the exact same thing. These conservatives like Bush, the Bushes of that day, said these are activist judges. Well, again, it's an attack on the separation of powers, because what he wants is the executive to rule, exactly what the founding fathers fought against.
Well, and I actually don't even think it's Bush, someone said. I don't think he's smart enough to know what to do with that. I think I've seen him give only given two open press conferences in his presidency where he didn't have the questions pre-given to him, where he could pick his reporters. And the one time I saw him do that, you could just totally tell he had no idea what he was talking about. He was repeating things as a puppet would. And basically, I think he had definitely like a Cheney, Rumsfeld, the backstage, and Papa Bush, and all that kind of thing that are really dictating what's going on. And he's just more of a character because his daddy was Bush, so he became president with a popular name.
Let's just see if we can keep Jeb out of there. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Dave. Dave's in Detroit. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. How's it going?
Going great.
Yeah, I was wanting to get your opinion or what you've heard about this Dick DeVos guy. Like, is he another one of these neocons? And what kind of dirty past do you know that he's got?
Well, he became a billionaire with this kind of Ponzi scheme.
Amway
pyramid scheme. And he's a far-right winger. Everything he's ever done, I looked at his ad. I said, man, are they slick? I mean, you'd think, oh, man, this guy knows what he's talking about. I mean, for instance, they're big supporters of school vouchers. So they want to be able to take our tax money and give it to kids so they can go to charter schools. And this is they were putting out this publication for a while, DeVos's, and I forgot the name of it. And here are these all-white Grand Rapidians, or whatever you'd call them, people from Grand Rapids, where they're from. And their publication is just all filled with African-American kids and saying how bad the Detroit schools are, and all of which is true. But the problem, I mean, that's a complex problem. But I remember some black minister said, when all of a sudden did all these rich conservative white people start being so concerned about little black kids in Detroit? So you'd think now, why would Dick DeVos and the rest of these people be concerned about them? Well, first off, they want to eliminate the whole concept of public schools because that's where one gets a, quote, liberal education. Secondly, they want to be able to insert kids into Christian schools and have us pay for it, again, violating the Constitution, which says that Congress shall make no law with establishment of religion. And thirdly, and that, you know, they're always so crass and power grasping, they want to destroy the power of the teachers' unions, not so anybody will get better education, but because the teachers' union, like so many other unions, are one of the mainstays of the Democratic Party.
Isn't that where Engler funneled a lot of money into the Grand Rapids area back when he was in there?
I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me.
And is that DeVos guy, is he a chicken hawk too, do you know?
I don't think none of those rich Republicans ever did any military service, so they just like to send working class kids and minority kids off to do the fighting.
Yeah, business as usual.
Business as usual. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's see here. Let's go to Will is at Selfridge Air Force Base up in Mount Clemens. Will, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, this is William Douglas. I'm just listening for the first time, but I'd call up and say, hey, I agree with you. The one thing I liked about Clinton was that at least he got his lid off with some of the women. I'm heterosexual, and I have to do anything with a gay. I don't promote it. I don't discourage it. Some of my good friends back in college, they did their testing and playing, but I said, the hell with it, and got married.
There you go. People take different paths in life. And as long as people aren't hurting anyone else, what do we care?
No, that's totally agreed. I mean, I'm in the Army. I fight with everybody else, but on my side of the line, I got the Marines, the Navy, and the Air Force. And me being in the Army and all the discrepancies in the past, doesn't matter who's behind the weapon. It's that battle buddy's going to save your ass.
I got you. Thank you, Will. Appreciate your call. Thanks for being a first-time listener and caller. Let's try. Here's Devon is back. Devon, hi. Are you with us this time?
Yeah.
Good. Go ahead. You're on the air. Devon, turn your radio off, okay?
Okay, it's off.
Okay. Now talk to me. You're on the air. It's Peter Werby.
Yeah, Peter, first of all, with the gay issue and gay marriages,
I really,
in the way the economy is now and the way everything's going, I think people have a right to just be happy. It's not really hurting anybody, and if you're dealing with it on a non-religious basis, then, you know, people just need to be able to do whatever they want to do.
As long as they're not hurting anyone.
Right, and I don't see how two same-sex marriages is really hurting anybody. I think it's just a control issue with Bush and his Republican friends and his rich friends, and him being from Texas, you know, how they look upon the gay situation. So I really think that that's something that as a whole shouldn't even be on our minds right now. There's too many other issues for us to be involved with, and people wanting to get married, people want to make each other happy.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Have you ever seen, sometimes they've had demonstrations where, like in Boston and San Francisco, where people have been, gays have been getting married. So you have these completely blissful, happy people, the people that are getting married, same-sex
right.
married, and they're loving one another, and they're smiling. And then on the other side, you have the righteous, right? And they're filled with hate and epithets and looking, you know, their face screwed up so they look like the ugliest people in the world. And so it turns out to be love versus hate. And someone, like I say, didn't have the nerve to go on the air, said, you know, that I was a queer lover. And I said, you're damn right I am. But all of that ought to recede into the background so we can judge people on the type of people they are and how they relate to life and to our community.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And as a whole, you know, gays and homosexuals are some of the most alcoholics and most, you know, they're just some of the best people. And I'm not gay myself, but just knowing them and having friends that are homosexual, they're the most happy, blissful people I ever know. You know, they tend to take everything very lightly because of the way they're treated. So, I mean, if they're happy, let them be happy.
Well, people should be happy. I agree. But, you know, there's also other issues. That is to say that, I mean, I have a spouse, and I can, well, I suppose you could jointly hold property with somebody else, but there are a lot of issues that have to do with, you know, health care and end-of-life issues and all sorts of other things like that that tell people, if they're forbidden to marry, that they can't invoke the same sort of rights as everyone else, that they're directed by whatever choice, which I don't think it is, or inner biology or whatever, and let love conquer all. All right, Devon, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here's Floyd. Floyd's in Bellevue. Floyd, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I kind of had a fairly simple question for you. Just as a young voter, I'm 20 years of age, moderate political knowledge, moderate political standing, and I know as well as you do that when we vote for a candidate, we're voting for the party as much as we're voting for the person. And from your perspective, what do you think that a Democrat candidate would offer me as a voter over a Republican?
Well, I'll tell you, if you listen to a lot of like liberal talk shows, of which there's not, most Democratic voters are pretty angry at the Democratic Party for not really having a unified program that talks about a renewal of this country. I mean, I voted for the first time in my life for a Democratic candidate for president in the last election, and I voted for the non-Bush. I mean, that John Kerry was such a disappointment as a candidate, and I hate to buy into their propaganda, but waffling on issues and not taking strong stands on things, because what they're hoping is, here's the Democratic Party hope, that the Republicans will have just so disgraced themselves and messed up everything that they've done that the people will just vote for them. So they still don't want to take a lot of forthright stands. Some people will, like Nancy Springer, who is I'm sorry, you live in Bellevue, so. Is this where what's his name, Thaddeus McCotter, is the in the House of Representatives?
Well, I live in Belleville, Michigan, not Bellevue.
I'm sorry. Bellevue is in Ontario. Belleville, right. It was written here wrong on the screen. Yeah.
Sorry, no problem.
Do you know, is it Representative McCotter?
I'm not 100% familiar right now. I'm actually a little bit out of the loop.
Okay, well, listen, there is a old colleague of mine, Tony Truppiano, who is forthright, who does have programs and policies and analyses. And if you go, you know, he's got a better website than this, but he used to be a talk show host. And if you go to thetonyshow.com, thetonyshow.com, you can see what Tony's program. It'll take you to his congressional website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know, I think me and a lot of people were very uncomfortable voting, you know, wanting to vote for Kerry. It's no one really knew what he was going to do with the war. We were afraid that if he decided to go forthright completely against the war, then he would have pulled us out too soon, and we would have had an entire country of people with an amazing level of animosity towards us.
Well, I think we have that now. We've accomplished that. Even the Shiites, the president of Iran, or is it the prime minister, has just accused the United States. This is our boy. He's just accused us, let's see here, if I can find this real quickly, that said that, well, I can't find it real quickly, but anyways, that the head guy is saying that United States troops regularly attack citizens. So, Iraqi citizens. So even, I think the desire to get the United States out of there is really at a peak.
Well, but from a perspective I know from my cousin, who's on his second tour over there right now, he says that for the most part, from the general public, he's well received. But there's always a fear level on his part, a fear level of the general public turning. But from his perspective, they're fairly generally well-received. They do want to take control. They definitely want to, you know, have their own government, run their own military, run their own police force. But from his perspective, and what I've heard from him time and time again, is he feels like over here things are misrepresented, that, you know, they're wanting him here. They're happy that, you know, men like him took out Saddam.
Well, you know
what he gets generally.
If you saw, if you were there in Belleville and some Chinese troops were over there, had invaded and occupied the United States and were walking down your street and had guns, wouldn't you probably have a tendency to say, hey, we're glad you're here? You know, that's, you know what? They've done poll after poll, and the vast majority of Iraqis want the U.S. out of there, and I think probably the majority of Americans as well. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Here's Josh. Josh is in West Bloomfield. Josh, hi. You're on the air. Josh, are you with me? I see. Sorry. Hey, there you go. Josh, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Great show tonight. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to comment on two issues. One was raised by one of your callers, and then the other you raised a little earlier. The first being the DeVos and Granholm election. I'm not thrilled with Granholm, and to an extent, I think she might be a little bit of a victim of circumstances, but there is a value in checks and balances in government, and with the Republican legislature, Republican domination in the state legislature, I really think that putting a Republican governor in power basically does away with that check and balance that's sorely needed in government. My second comment is on the interplay of war and politics that you raised with Iran and Iraq. Part of politics is the means to influence others to do what you want. On the spectrum of the means of exercising, I guess, that power and influence, on one end you've got negotiation, and on the other end you've got force. So historically the United States has used negotiation as a carrot, somewhat dangling it in front of nations like Iran and North Korea and attaching conditions associated with those negotiations. Force is really the least productive means of influencing others to do what you want, and using force means you can't influence others at all through your words, and it's admission of failure. what confuses me is most politicians are probably pretty smart people. I tend to give them the doubt they're relatively educated, and it's just this has gone forgotten on most of the people in power today, and it's just astonishing to me, and I'll hang up and listen to your comment. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Well, I think you said it well. And on the other hand, that force has worked historically for the United States in a way. Because I was thinking of this book that I interviewed the author of a few weeks ago, Stephen Kinzer, K-I-N-Z-E-R. If you go to my website, peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com, go down the left side and click on books, and it'll take you to where that is. His new book is called Overthrow, and it's a history of U.S. violence towards other countries over the last 100 years. And it's incredible. I mean, the United States went all over the world, from Hawaii to the Dominican Republic to Nicaragua to Honduras to Chile to to invade countries, overthrow governments, many and most of which were democratically elected, to establish police state, torture state dictators so that were sympathetic to United States corporate interests. And some people will say that, well, this worked in the short run, but the end of it all didn't work out well because there was chaos in the country, or there was, go look at Congo. Congo now for, 40 years or so has been this disaster where literally millions of people have died. One of the things that began it all was the CIA assassination of this man named Patrice Lumumba. So most people look at what's happening today, and you see, oh, man, that's terrible. Why are those people so crazy? Well, most of the countries in Africa weren't ever countries until they were invaded by colonial powers from Europe primarily, and then these artificial boundaries were left for people to operate as a political state. Many times they were done so specifically so that they would be weakened. As France, and particularly France and Britain, withdrew, they made sure that these national boundaries that they drew up would never allow them to have internal peace, and that sometimes they could still muck around in their affairs. So when you see the continuing problems of Iraq or Lebanon or the whole Middle East, you know that the Western countries ultimately are responsible for it all. Same with a lot with Asia as well. Same a lot with Latin America. That imperialism, colonialism has left its mark and is a root of all the chaos we see today. And part of it is, of course, is to keep this country extraordinarily wealthy and a particular small class within our country particularly wealthy, and having looted other sectors of the country. So that gets back to the immigration. So we have this poor country to our south. How the hell did that happen? Why is this line in across this peninsula mean above it you do okay, below it you don't do okay? Well, again, there's been systematic looting of the Mexican economy. So what we have now is the most industrious, the people with the skills and qualities we most admire decide, I have to come north to get the jobs where they are. All right, 313-298-WRIF, still a lot about gay marriage, and let's see, here is Ron. Ron's in a town not named. Where are you, Ron?
Right here.
Yeah, where, but what city are you in?
Livonia.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Peter.
Yes.
Hello. Yeah, earlier you said first of all, I want to try to make some comments that'll tie together the oil prices about which you've spoken, the trade deficit about which you comment perhaps every week, the dollar crisis, which you haven't said much about, the trade agreements that we're always running to try to get more and more people to trade with the United States. There's a reason for this. Militarization of space and ultimately fascism right in here in the United States. It has to do with the fact that first, which you probably agree to, the United States is an empire, but I don't think most Americans realize that. We're an empire.
Okay.
Secondly, we've accomplished this empire through what has been identified by two authors I have here that I want to mention as dollar debt imperialism. Now, that most people will not be familiar with at all, and unfortunately, because they're not familiar with it, they won't have a clue as to what kind of nightmare we're facing. You mentioned just a little while ago that the high oil prices are okay with the oil producers. That's only partially true, Peter.
Go ahead.
Because it's creating a crisis for them. Russians have complained about this mightily. This is why they're moving away from the dollar. They all end up, when they sell their oil, they sell it in dollars. They're ending up with just tons and tons of dollars, which are basically worthless. And it's creating a crisis that's so severe, it's one of the reasons why the recent Secretary of Treasury quit in this country. And the Bush regime had a hell of a problem getting this guy from Goldman Sachs to come in to try to do something about it. And there's going to be limited things he can do.
Well, let me say that there is, before you go on, I mean, there is a move towards beginning to trade in petro-euros rather than petro-dollars. Some people think that when Saddam Hussein began talking about that, that really sealed his fate.
The author, F. William Engdahl, who has a website, and I hope you'll let me mention
sure,
it.
Sure.
Your people should, you and your audience need to go there and read this. He points out that trading oil in euros will not be much of a threat to the dollar hegemony, as people think, but the United States no doubt wishes to discourage it and will take some severe action just to prevent anybody from starting to challenge the dollar. But here's how it works. In a nutshell, when we trade, first of all, the United States is bleeding. You often say we're the richest country. Peter, we're not. What we do, what we are, is a huge vampire sucking wealth out of our trading partners. This means the wealthy countries, Europe, that's Germany and France and Japan, we are sucking money out. There's a net transfer of wealth from those countries to this country, and this has occurred, Peter, since around 1971, when the government went belly up here, when we were bankrupt, and Nixon told the central banks of his trading partners, we're not going to exchange dollars, gold for dollars.
Okay.
Now, this most
took us off the gold standard, right?
No, it's not just the gold standard; it's the transfer. The point is that most people may have ignored that, but actually it was an important thing. One of the authors I wish to introduce you to, and if you could manage to do an interview with this guy and at least have his website available, that it would really be great. This guy's name is Michael Hudson. He's a professor. He got his degree over at U of M.
Now, that's an easy one to remember, but do me a favor and email it to me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Well, okay, but let me try to wrap this up.
Okay, do that.
The book is called Super Imperialism: The Economic Strategy of American Empire. Now, the other guy that your audience should visit is a guy by the name of F. W. Engdahl. That's spelled Engdahl. Dahl. He's got a site called engdahl.oilgeopolitics.net. Now, the problem is this, Peter. The world is...
Wait, what's the... Tell me the name of the website again.
Well, it would be, the typical HTTP.
Yeah.
And you'd have then the www, that business. And it's Engdahl, Engdahl, .oilgeopolitics,
okay.
All one word, .net.
All right. What I need, though? Speaking of commercial stuff, I got to go to some. So give me a final couple sentences.
Well, all right. Here's the thing, that Americans have got to realize that there's an economic storm coming at us because the world is basically attempting to rebel against this system of dollar hegemony, and it's basically going to cause an economic train wreck. So I'm suggesting here at home, people had better consider a general strike because they're going to have to literally... They're going to have to legislate from the street to protect themselves. This is why we have fascism. This is why Bush is stripping our constitutional rights. It's not terrorism. It's the fact that they understand that the economy is going to be falling apart in the near future, and they mean to impose martial law and probably put us in work camps. It's that severe. People had better take it seriously. This is the reason why things are going the way they're going.
All right, Ron, we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you. There's a lot to digest there. I appreciate it. Now, that probably seemed pretty dire, and a lot, particularly the end of it, did seem to me to be a bit extreme as a prediction. The other, much of what Ron is saying, though, it should be thought about. And these things about the economy are extraordinarily complex, and most people are only dealing with what is right in front of us at the immediate time. Do we have a good job? Have we just lost our job and have to get one at lower pay? What are our prospects for employment if we're just coming out of high school or college, and on like that? But there are people that are looking at trends, and they don't look good. I think there is a real bolster for the dollar. I'll talk about that when we come back.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
To love the God, and to fear the rain. And
we're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our final segment. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, we'll be airing an interview I did with the co-author of a book that wrote about the experience of gay marriage in the country where it's been legal the longest, Denmark, since 1989. But we were talking about the economy, and here's an editorial from May 29th in the New York Times. The interest must be paid. And this is, the younger you are, the more important this editorial is to you, because you're going to be paying longer. So here's part of it. By definition, federal borrowing eventually results in a transfer of income from American taxpayers whose taxes go to pay the interest on the debt to the investors who hold the Treasury bonds. Now, what this means is that there was a surplus in the Treasury, but because Bush started a war and has given away $200 billion, $300 billion, and has also given a tax cut to his wealthy buddies, it means we've become a debtor nation. So we need money to keep operating, so the country sells Treasury bonds. So what this says is there's going to be a transfer of income from you, and again, like if you're 19 and just starting to work, well, you'll be doing it for 50 years or something like that. And the Times says, as long as the bonds are owned by Americans, the transfer is simply from one group of citizens to another. Bondholders may get richer while taxpayers who don't own bonds get poorer, which could add to troubling disparities in personal wealth. But shuffling the income between the two groups doesn't reduce American overall wealth. But it's still a process of looting by one class over the other. Today, however, they say 43% of United States publicly held debt of $4.8 trillion, that's how deeply Bush has got us in debt, is held abroad, mainly by central banks in Japan, China, and Britain, and by what are called offshore hedge funds. Doesn't matter. Means you're going to work, and a portion of what you earn is going to be taken by the government, transferred to the bondholders, who may be a hedge fund from one of these little islands in, you know, Bahamas or something like that. That's up from 30% share in 2001, an extraordinary increase. And indeed, during the Bush years, 73% of new government borrowing has been from abroad. Paying the interest on the foreign-owned portion of the debt will be a burden on future Americans, draining their wallets and siphoning off the nation's wealth. This is what these incompetent, evil morons are leaving office with. They'll be rich. They'll still have everything they want, but let me say that sentence again, but change just the word a little. Paying the interest on the foreign-owned portion of the debt will be a burden on future Americans, draining your wallets and siphoning off the nation's wealth. So it's a transfer that you're going to be working to give money that Bush screwed up on to a bank in China or Japan or England. No one knows the future, they say, but we can size up our present reality. America is living beyond its means, and foreigners are increasingly supporting the excess in exchange for a government guarantee that a chunk of Americans' future collective income will benefit them, not the Americans who earn it. Shouldn't Bush's popularity be at about 2%? Only the truly mad? Man. All right, I want to take this call just because it's from Canada, Norman, then I'll get to the other one. Here's Bruce in Picton, Ontario. Thanks for making our program international. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, good evening. This is Bruce.
And, hi, Bruce.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that I'm a fan of your show, and I used to do community radio in Toronto.
Really?
And for 11 years on the University of Toronto station. And another guy who's a big fan of all kinds of radio is an old friend of yours, Ron Sokolsky.
Oh, yeah, I know Ron, sure. He lives out on the west coast of Canada now.
Finally. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I wanted to mention also that big news item in Toronto this weekend, the war on terror is alive and well in Toronto. They arrested some Arab Canadians with some so-called ammonium nitrate. And apparently with the purpose of blowing up the CN Tower in Toronto. This is the story anyway.
Yeah, 17 arrested, of mostly of South Asian ancestry, and they were, 3 tons of this fertilizer of the type that was used to blow up the Murta federal building in Oklahoma City. Sounded pretty scary.
Well, and something just occurred to me in that I've been doing quite a bit of research the last little while, and I believe I sent you an email on a string a little while ago about the so-called 9/11 truth movement.
Sure.
That's happening around North America and different pockets here and there.
Uh-huh.
And one of the fellows who was quite involved with that is a man named Barry Zwicker, who is a broadcaster and media critic from Toronto. And he was one of the first guys who looked into, you know, the fact that four airliners were traveling around for a very long time that day with no interception. And he was one of the first international broadcasters to be questioning that. But now they're calling the whole thing a movement, if you will. And I wanted to let the listeners know that there is a conference happening this weekend in Chicago.
This coming weekend?
No, it's this weekend as we speak.
Well, the weekend has just ended 44 minutes ago.
Okay. Well, there you go then.
Yeah.
I'm just saying this past weekend.
Okay.
Okay. June 2nd to 4th.
Okay.
That'll put a context on it.
Yeah.
And apparently there were over 40 of these researchers and different authors and scientists. I wondered whether you yourself had a chance to look at any of the documentaries like Loose Change or Confronting the Evidence,
well,
or actually check into any of this research yourself.
I have some of it, and I was kind of shocked by Loose Change, of the proposition that it puts forth, that that two of these planes never crash, but actually what do you call people on planes? The passengers, thank you. The passengers actually landed in Cleveland and are somehow being held secretly. I mean, I think that is such a pack of nonsense.
So when you got past Loose Change, did you sort of dismiss the whole rest of it as conspiracy crock? Or?
Well, I mean, there are conspiracies, certainly, to alter the whole nature of this country and how it's ruled. And the whole nature of the economy and all that. So, yeah, I think there are conspiracies. But I think that all you have to – I never understood this. All you have to say – and I'm not saying very few – I'm not even judging other parts of the 911 deal. But that it was such a catastrophic failure of security and intelligence on the part of the Bush regime that should have been enough to have him removed from office forthwith, rather than giving him all of this power. I mean, that all the information, I knew that Al-Qaeda was planning an event in the United States because, guess what? It was in the daily papers, and Bush was presented with the memos that told him this was occurring. If all the other stuff about the failure of the scrambled jets and a bunch of other stuff is also true, good, go get this guy. I mean, because he should be driven from office.
Well, I'll tell you what really got me compelled, Pete, was the Stephen Jones stuff. He's the guy that's been doing a lot of research into the collapse of the buildings.
Yeah.
And you look at a lot of these the footage of the collapse of the buildings, and it sure as heck looks like controlled explosions in there.
Well, I know, but all this thing about what hit the Pentagon and what crashed in the Pennsylvania field, I think that's sort of a dead end, and I think it's very possible for people to get diverted solely into that. I mean, if the proofs are out there, and nobody's picking up on it. Nobody's picking up on, I mean, the mainstream media doesn't pick up on a lot of this stuff. I mean, one of the things that people ought to get a look at to understand the crisis we face is go to the Rolling Stone site. Just go to rollingstone.com, and it shows definitively how the Bush machine stole the 2004 election. Most of us listening to this broadcast know that he stole the 2000 election. But this shows how that over 350,000 voters were prevented from voting in Ohio, and how they were counted. Actually, I'm towards the end of the show, so I'm going to have to move on. But I always have an open mind about this stuff. But like I said, though, Bruce, for people to put 100% of their energy into that, I think allows a lot of other issues to go by. I mean, there's enough for 9/11 on the basis of failure for Bush to be impeached. This is called misfeasance. I'm sorry, misfeasance in office. Of course, there's all this malfeasance as well. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Here is Tim in Rochester. Tim, hey, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
Doing good.
Okay, real quick, gay marriage, who cares? You know, as long as they're happy and they're going to live their life and contribute to society, big deal.
Hey, Tim, let me just say something. Remember the beginning, you must have been listening towards the beginning of the show. Remember I said, can anyone show me how society is hurt or anyone is hurt by gay marriage? And never got a single call. One guy, you may have heard me say that, called me, or didn't even call, called our producer and phone screener, Norma, and said, you're a queer lover.
No,
that's it. That shows you the level at which we're dealing with opposition.
People living in their own thing. And that's the problem with America. You know, the country was founded to have freedom, pure and simple freedom from everything, government and religion included. I mean, if you watch, like, the Catholic Channel, they praised Mel Gibson for The Passion of the Christ. They're condemning Ron Howard and Tom Hanks for The Da Vinci Code. Everybody knows The Da Vinci Code's probably just a story. It's not really true, but who cares? It's entertainment. All the other religious movies, you know, I don't see them going out there and protesting them because it was such a big deal. You know, they get too involved in that stuff because they're worried about the fiber of America. And so, you know, all the terrorism and stuff. And now it's like commission conversion with the religions now, which is no good.
Commission conversion.
What's
that?
You got to want to convert on your own.
Oh.
You know, who cares? I mean, if they want to tell you what they think of, you know, well, this is the way you should believe in God and whatever, fine. But, you know, it's like they browbeat you into doing it.
Well, the other thing is, can they please just let it all be voluntary? So the government shouldn't be an instrument of religious policy, that's for sure, or religious doctrine. And so the people that don't like gay marriage, don't get married to somebody of the same sex. Get somebody married of the opposite sex. It settles it. You don't like gay people, don't talk to them. They probably don't want to talk to you either. I don't mean you, but the people that feel like that. Tim, thanks. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Simone. Simone's in Detroit. Hey, Simone, you're on the air.
Hello, yes. I would like to comment about the oil crisis that you were talking about.
Sure.
And actually, I have a question. As far as the Fahrenheit 9/11 movie, is there actually truth in that as far as Bush and his family owning the oil company? And if so, how can he do that? Isn't that like a conflict of interest?
Well, I don't think anymore that the Bush family directly owns oil wells, but they're all connected in together, and they have these interlocking directorates of these conglomerates, and they're buddy buddies. They hang out together. They as a matter of course, like people in a union, like they operate in terms of their own best interest as workers, like the electrical workers union or something like that. The same thing with the Richies. They have their class interests, and they stick together pretty good.
But isn't like the whole purpose of the president to I guess, be concerned with the good of all people and not just, you know, a certain chunk, like you say, his rich buddies? I mean, that kind of seems kind of false. And isn't there something that we could do to, like, impeach him for that?
Well, there is. There's a lot of movement beneath the surface for impeachment. I mean, what you're saying, Simone, is essentially the model of the way the system is supposed to work. That's what we all learned in civics class. And there's a balance of power and we look out for one another and we take care of the weakest and the sickest and what have you.
That helps the poser, though.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. I don't know what's going to happen or what we have the capacity to do. Mostly the American people have just been rolling over for a loss of rights and being frightened to death and a million other things that this grant more and more power to the executive branch, which is, I said earlier, is exactly what the founding fathers fought against.
Thank
you, Simone.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You have a good one. Hey, before we get out of here, I should remind you again to join us at the Club BART. Club BART's in Ferndale, and it's for Jolene Jordan's CD release party. It's going to be this Wednesday. at 9 p.m., Club Bard in Ferndale, on Woodward, just south of Nine Mile Road, right across from the Ferndale Post Office. Jalene Jordan, WRIF DJ formerly, also formerly my co-host and producer on the old IE America Radio Network. I'm going to go out of here with a cough. Wow. What was that all about? But anyways, she's got a brand new CD out called What She Said. You can go to Jalene Jordan, J-U-L-I-N-E, JaleneJordan.com and see it. Or better yet, for right now, because it's not fully up and running, go to my website, Peter Werbe, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. Go to the calendar and go over to the left and see the you know, how to click onto that. And you can listen to some of her music and connect up to her website as well. All right, so I'll see some of you at Bard's Club Bard on Wednesday. Other than that, we'll talk again next week directly. Stay tuned for some interesting interviews.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. If you've been watching the news, not much of a pleasure these days, but something a little odious happened in one of the committees. There a constitutional amendment that would bar gay marriages, that would define marriage as only being between a man and a woman, passed in a United States Senate committee. There's been a lot about gay marriage in the last few years. We were shamed here in Michigan by adding provision like that to our state constitution, and since then we found that a lot of attitudes have changed. People have a lot of assumptions about gay marriage, and there's a book that's just come my way that I think is worth examining with one of its co-authors. The book is called Gay Marriage, For Better or For Worse, What We've Learned from the Evidence, and joining me is the co-author Darren R. Spadala. He's a corporate attorney at White & Case in New York City, and he spent 2 years on a Fulbright fellowship in Denmark researching Scandinavian same-sex partnership. With William N. Eskridge Jr., he has written the book Gay Marriage, For Better or For Worse. Joining me from New York City, Darren Spadala. Darren, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, this is normally I would get all the facts and figures out of this, but when I started reading about this and read that essentially, and I hope we're not giving the book away right at the beginning, that it affirms gay marriage as a worthy part of the institution of marriage, I was reminded when I heard once the African-American scholar Lewis Henry Gates Jr., who said, "I resent having to spend any of my time proving I'm not a monkey."
Right.
So, go ahead. So you get where I'm going with that. I mean, you're essentially have written this very informative book, Gay Marriage, in order to show, hey, we're human beings.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think the reason for this book coming about was that looking at the history of the gay marriage debate, it has been a very heated debate. It has involved a lot of rhetoric and a lot of sort of name-calling on both sides. And at a certain point, it really comes down to looking at what the facts are of what's really being argued. And if we look at what's going on in Congress today, the reason for this new amendment, they call it the Marriage Protection Amendment, which in itself is an interesting name, which implies that it needs to be protected. The institution of marriage needs to be protected from gays and lesbians being allowed to marry. And when you really sort of question that assumption, well, what are you protecting it from? That's where our book comes into play. The idea here is, among conservatives, the argument is we need to protect it because if you allow gays and lesbians to marry, it will lead to harm to the institution of marriage and most likely to children of marriages in the United States as well, or children in general. And so basically, based on that assumption, we decided to look at those countries in the world, the first countries to extend all of the rights and responsibilities of marriage to same-sex couples. As you may know, Denmark in 1989 was the first country to extend all of the rights and responsibilities of marriage to gays and lesbians. And so based on a 17-year history now, we can look at that country as well as the other Scandinavian countries that have allowed same-sex couples to enter into what they call registered partnerships but have all of the rights and responsibilities of marriage, similar to our civil unions here, and see what happens when you will extend these rights to gays and lesbians. Does it end the institution of marriage, or does it actually, you know, improve the institution? Those are the kinds of things we look at in this book.
Yeah, I mean, so as far as I know, Denmark has not gone to hell in a handbasket since 1989. Hey, well, tell me just a little of the history, how you wound up doing this. I mean, if I was going to do a book on this, I guess the first thing that would not occur to me would not be to go off to Denmark, although I'm glad you did because you certainly have come back with a lot of good information. But what was the impetus for all of this? Simply that it had been there for so long, being allowed?
Well, I think from my own personal perspective, it was seeing that there's a huge fear of the unknown. My personal interest in this had begun as when I was at Duke University many years ago and had done a cost-benefit analysis on the extension of domestic partnership benefits from an employer's perspective. At that time, in the early 90s, domestic partnership benefits were something new, and a lot of employers were very concerned about giving benefits to same-sex couples. In other words, giving benefits to the domestic partner of an employee the same way they would to a spouse of an employee because they didn't know what the results were going to be. They're like, will this be bad for my business? Will this cause problems? And so we see the same fear of the unknown now with same-sex marriage. People are always scared of what they don't know. And unfortunately, that often leads a lot of opportunists who have an agenda to come and say, well, you need to stop gay marriage now because it will lead to all of these terrible effects. We will just end up regretting it as a society if we allow gays and lesbians to get married. And so I think the reason for doing this was to say, hey, we know what the facts are. We can look at these countries very similar to the U.S. We can see what the results of marriage are, and we can actually evaluate whether or not gay marriage in the U.S. would be a good or a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't mean to be a pushy talk show host, so you know I'm going to be one, right? But you didn't really say, I mean, is there some resentment of having to do this, having to prove yourself? I mean, look at how miserable heterosexual marriages often are and how many of them wind up in divorce and how much child abuse and spousal abuse there are. I mean, why in the hell should anybody have to, as a group, prove themselves? I mean, it has a distinct political purpose, and this book, your book, Gay Marriage, certainly serves that. But I'm wondering on a personal level, isn't it kind of insulting as a human being on the planet?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when two mature adults love one another and pledge to spend the rest of their lives together, and they want to protect each other the same as any other couple does, it is very upsetting when there are people out there who say, I don't want you to have the same rights as I have, just because, from what I know about you, I think you're not worthy of that. And I think one of the major turning points probably would have been AIDS and the result of AIDS in the mid-80s, because that was the first time there was some visibility of gays and lesbians. And what a lot of people saw was when you had partners who'd been together for 20 years or longer, 25 years, and spend their whole lives together, and then one of the partners dies of this terrible disease. And then legally, the family can just come in and take everything that their relative had had, and there were no legal rights available to the other partner. They had to sit and suffer in silence while every last memory of their deceased partner was taken away from them.
Hmm.
Everything from finances to, you know, maybe their favorite piece of clothing that they remembered their partner by. And I think that was the first time that people started to wake up to the idea that, you know what, these people, gays and lesbians, are, you know, having the same types of relationships we have. They go to work just like we do. Many of them are raising families. They have children, which is becoming more and more common. And so that's why I think you see also these changes in attitudes all over the United States relatively quickly. And part of that, obviously, is going to be the more exposure that somebody has to knowing a friend or an acquaintance or a coworker who's gay, and the more they talk to them and the more that they actually realize these are people just like me and they have their own lives and their own careers and even their own families, that's where you actually start to change minds. It's being out there and being... But yes, absolutely, your original question, I think it is very difficult for a lot of people to feel like they have to justify. They pay the same taxes as everyone else, and they're getting less benefits because they pay into a system where married couples get certain benefits that they are not receiving, even though they're paying for them. And I think that a lot of people feel resentment about all of those aspects of this.
Darren Spedale is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's co-author of Gay Marriage, For Better or For Worse, What We've Learned from the Evidence. It's published by Oxford University Press, and there's a website connected with it you may want to check out, gaymarriagebook.com. There's interviews with the author and authors and other related material as well. Now, attitudes have really been improving. We've been looking at these polls that they've reported in the press, and suddenly, you know, the idea and acceptability of gay marriage has improved considerably. And yet, I wonder, well, as you said, Darren, about knowing people and understanding people, but this is a book, your book, filled with very interesting facts, and we should get to them. But so much of it, I think, previously is just based on the prejudicial attitude of homophobia. Nothing to do with whether marriages are really under attack, you know, heterosexual traditional marriages, or whether it will cost more or anything like that. But just flat out homophobia.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, let's face it, those two words together, gay marriage, for many people in this country, elicit an emotional response. It's they hear that and they have an automatic negative response, sometimes an automatic positive response, depending on who you are. But a lot of people don't spend the time to actually think about what that really means. Of people who are actually raising children, having families, you know, taking their kids to Disneyland the same way any other family does. They don't get to that sort of level of, you know, thinking through the process. They just hear those two words, and it just elicits the reaction. They say, I'm against it, and they don't want to have any more thought on the process. And we're trying, hopefully, with this book, to get to people, to enlighten people a little bit more and say, you know what, you know, a lot of couples are living together, they're raising families, and it's not leading to any real problems. In fact, there are actually some benefits we see to those societies that have allowed their same-sex couples to basically marry.
Well, let's do that. Let's get to the what we've learned from the evidence, the subtitle of Gay Marriage,
sure.
For Better or for Worse. I don't even know if anyone listening could come up with any concrete objection, some of these far right-wing ideologues maybe, but the average person, they say, well, wait a minute, gay marriage, that's going to... What's it? I'm sure nothing forms in their mind.
Well, I think you have two different sides, and then you have a middle section. On the one hand, you have people who sort of understand, yes, allowing gays and lesbians to marry is the right thing to do. It goes to equality. It goes to fairness. It goes to the fact that, you know, they have families and they want their children to feel as legitimized as any other family. On the other hand, you have people who say gay marriage is just morally wrong. From a religious perspective, I feel that it's a man and a woman, and that's what the Bible says. And I think on both of those sides, you're really not going to have a lot of flexibility for argument. But there's this middle group. This middle group thinks, well, I'm not particularly, for biblical or religious reasons, opposed to the concept of gay marriage, but a lot of people are out there right now, a lot of conservative congressmen, telling me that if I allowed or approved of allowing gays and lesbians to marry, it's going to have a negative effect on our society. It's going to lead to the downfall of the institution of marriage. And so to explain what those conservative arguments are, I'll sort of go into more detail now so you sort of explain what people are actually saying about why they need to protect marriage.
Sure.
What a lot of conservatives are saying is that if gays and lesbians could marry, it would lead to a disinterest in the actual institution of marriage for heterosexual couples, that, you know, the institution will have widened in a way that it makes the institution less meaningful. And therefore, allowing gays and lesbians to marry is going to cause a lot more heterosexual couples just to live together without getting married. It leads to more sort of cohabitation and more loosely formed relationships. The second part of that argument is because they're not getting married and they're looser relationships, they're more likely to break up. And also a lot of those relationships involve children, and those children will therefore be harmed by these more loosely formed relationships when there is a breakup. So more children will end up with single parents.
Well, you know what? I mean, this is terrible to interject, but I feel like telling those people, get a hobby or something else. You know, get out of other people's lives. But they're not going to, and one of the ways that we can deal with this is refuting some of those arguments. So I'm sorry to butt in. Go ahead. It just infuriates me, actually, and I can imagine how you feel. Go ahead.
That's the thing. You know, a lot of conservatives have really been sort of reaching for straws as to how to sort of prove that they're protecting marriage, and this was sort of the best argument right now that they've been able to come up with, is that we need to protect it from this downfall of the institution. And now sort of the argument has shifted away from, you know, gays and lesbians should not be allowed to marry because they're not as worthy as heterosexuals. Because that sounded like such a mean-sounding argument, they've moved more to, we have nothing against gays and lesbians, but we don't want anything bad to happen to heterosexual couples and to children in the country.
So what is the experience in Denmark? You were there for 2 years.
There for 2 years. I conducted a lot of research, empirical research, not only there, but Norway and Sweden, the other countries that have had a form of same-sex marriage now for over a decade. Interviews with everything from politicians, activists, sociologues, a lot of archival research. And the whole point of this was to say, well, what does happen when a country has gay marriage? What does it lead to? And I think what we found, based on that conservative argument, is that all of these negative effects posited by conservatives do not occur, which is to say that we do not see decreasing levels of marriage and increased levels of divorce. In fact, interestingly enough, in the years after Denmark was the first country to allow same-sex couples to enter into these relationships, the rates of heterosexual marriage went up and the rates of heterosexual divorce went down, exactly opposite of what conservatives would have predicted would have happened after gays and lesbians were allowed to marry. So that's a pretty big deal, because that basically goes to the heart of what this whole protectionist idea is. And in fact, we also saw that the rates of non-marital births, which is to say children born out of wedlock, in the years after gay marriage was passed, stopped rising, and they leveled off.
Huh.
So what you see out there is a lot of conservatives who are trying to argue cause and effect. They're saying that gay marriage causes, you know, the down, you know, more heterosexuals to cohabit rather than marry and live without a marriage license. What we see is those changes really took place, for the most part, to the extent they took place, in the 70s and the early 80s, the mid-80s, because if you look from the late 60s to the mid-80s, there was a huge jump in each of those countries, and the United States as well, of couples who lived together without getting married, and a huge jump in divorce rates as well. But what we've seen in those years that after gay marriage was passed, that actually those levels actually declined somewhat. You know, the decline of the divorce rate and the increase in the marriage rate, and at the same time, there was a slight decline in the non-marital birth rate, which is to say there was less children being born out of wedlock after gay marriage was passed than before.
Well, Darren, your argument actually is very strong because you're starting with their premise and proving them wrong. I would say and suspect that gays marrying one another has absolutely nothing to do with heterosexual marriage or divorce or children born out of wedlock.
I think that, you know, it's exactly right. I mean, the sort of joke we were talking about is sort of, you know, John and Sue sitting around the kitchen table saying, well, you know, we used to think about getting married, but now that gays and lesbians can do it, we don't think we want to do it anymore, you know. And that's obviously just ridiculous. I mean, if somebody does that, like you said, they probably should get a life.
Yeah.
I think, yes, we kind of drive a stake right through the heart of this defense of marriage argument. In other words, there's nothing to defend marriage from, as much as they would like to sort of say there is. The evidence points differently. And in fact, when we did interviews with a number of couples and other research, we found that there are actually some benefits to a society in allowing their gays and lesbians to be able to get married. And I'd be happy to
Yeah, well, I was thinking about our community, which is sort of three or four suburbs just north of Detroit, which is probably one of the, or some of the more liberal places. And there's numerous gay couples. Naturally, they can't marry in Michigan because of the prohibition in the Constitution now. And they add to the diversity. I know that sounds very PC to say, but living, to me, living in a diverse community is a very, is a plus of all sorts of different people, because people bring so much different interesting stuff. I mean, and this is a country that doesn't have a single origin. Maybe if you're, you know, French or Danish or something like that, living, well, they don't even any so much anymore, but living in a homogeneous cultural country, if they have deep roots, but this country doesn't have any deep roots. So, hey, let's all get together and didn't some great philosopher say, let's all get along?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I think that, I mean, in states like Michigan and the Midwest and all over the United States, you have a growing number of couples every year who are, you know, living their lives together and, you know, planning on spending the rest of their lives together. I do think that among a younger gay generation, whereas maybe in the 50s and 60s, the idea of sort of getting married and settling down and having a family for a lot of gay couples was sort of a pipe dream or almost something ridiculous, you know, in the new generation, with the advent of all of the normalization of gays and lesbians over the last 20 years, not only from the outside but from the inside as well, you have the great majority of gays and lesbians want to find their special someone or already have found their special someone and plan to spend the rest of their lives together. And more, the younger the gay and lesbian generation you talk to, the more and more they want to have children and a family, and you see that in Michigan as well as everywhere else. And, you know, those people need the same legal protections as any other couple. They need the protections that if one of them dies or becomes incapacitated, that the other person is going to be able to take care of the family, that they'll be able to inherit from that partner, that they can make decisions for them if they're in the hospital and become fully incapacitated. All those things are things that any couple needs, regardless of sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I would say to people listening, since I don't know how many of you, I hope a lot, are going to go out and get the book. This isn't a dry book of statistics and comparison. There's a lot of good stories in here.
One of the most interesting parts of the book really is that we just do these long, you know, full-day interviews with all of these same-sex couples that have gotten married. And let them tell their stories about what it means for them to be married in a relationship. And it's just so amazing, some of the stories that we heard from many of these gay and lesbian couples about what getting married meant to them. And you just hear all different kinds of stories. Like, for example, an interesting story and something that's a benefit, obviously, is a number of couples explained how in previous relationships, before there was gay marriage, when there was a difficult time or, a tough time that they and their partner were going through, it was very simple for them to sort of just pick up their suitcases and leave. You know, that was the end of it. I don't have to do anymore. But once they had gotten married, in a subsequent relationship, they realized that they couldn't just walk out. There is a whole process of divorce, and rather than just, going through that process, they spent a lot more time thinking about what the nature of the relationship meant to them, taking time to make compromises, and really saying, we want this to work, I love you, this is our marriage. And they stayed together because of the stability that they, being in this legal relationship, gave them.
Well, Darren Spadali, you and your co-author, William Eskridge, Jr., you've written Gay Marriage for Better or for Worse, What We've Learned from the Evidence. You're both attorneys, so maybe you could address did you chuckle?
It's always dangerous to have attorneys on a show, huh?
Anyway, so here we have in the foundation legal document of the state of Michigan a prohibition against gay marriage. It would be almost comparable to saying only whites could marry, or only Gentiles, Christian Gentiles could marry, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And plus we have, what is it, the National Defense of Marriage Act?
That's right.
Yeah. What reactionary president, what far-right winger signed that one?
Oh, well, that was a midnight signing, apparently, back in the day by a not-so-reactionary president, but one that was pushed into a corner, I guess, in a very tough period, I think times have changed a lot in the last decade, and I would, of course, wonder if that would be signed so quickly as it was then as now, especially since attitudes have changed so much.
Clinton, you don't want to say, but I'll say it was Bill Clinton. But, yeah, you're right. He was in a tricky spot at the time. But so where are we legally? I mean, there is a bulwark of pretty heavy magnitude here. I mean, everyone's almost positive that this defense of... this marriage protection amendment is going nowhere and is just right-wing posturing for the base. But there's incredible legal impediments.
Well, you should take that in itself as a sign of how much things have changed over the last two decades. I mean, could you imagine in 1970, if an amendment had come up saying marriage is between a man and a woman, who would have objected? Very, very few people. And the fact that it's coming up again in Congress next week, and it doesn't look like it has much of a chance of passing, I think says a lot about how quickly society is changing and how much we are on our way for people to recognize and embrace gays and lesbians just like anyone else. Now, you mentioned DOMA. Obviously, DOMA does two things. DOMA, on the one hand, says that the federal government does not recognize the ability of gays and lesbians to marry, and also says that states don't have to recognize same-sex marriages performed in another state. There's so much litigation going on right now in the issue of same-sex marriages around the country. It's hard for anyone to keep up. It's almost like a daily basis. There's a new development. Somebody's either passed a new domestic partnership regime, or there's been a new challenge to same-sex marriage bans. I think probably one of the lessons of this book as well, and a very important lesson, is the need for gays and lesbians and their supporters to work through legislatures rather than the courts to get things done. Now, the Scandinavian countries were also very important because they were the first place where activists worked with legislatures to find the compromise. There, the compromise was calling it something other than marriage. They called it registered partnerships, even though it gave all of the rights and responsibilities of marriage. But that little change made the difference for allowing them to be able to pass basically de facto gay marriage in the States with all the rights and responsibilities there of marriage. Here in the States, I think one of the lessons we state in this book is that more and more people are going to start working with the legislatures to show why this stuff is needed, why same-sex couples need all of the rights and benefits of marriage. To stay away from some of the courts, I don't know that the Roberts Court is really going to be our greatest ally at this point in time. It seems to a lot of gay and lesbian legal activists are doing their best to keep those cases out of the Supreme Court for very good reason.
I would think that was a good reason. We're actually out of time. More in the book, Gay Marriage, for Better or for Worse, What We've Learned from the Evidence. Darren Spadali has been our guest, and he spent 2 years in Denmark researching Scandinavian same-sex partnerships. And his co-author is William Eskridge. The book is published by Oxford University Press. You can go to Gay Marriage. marriagebook.com, and there'll be more interviews with the authors and also more information as well. Darren Spedale, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer before they hit it big. Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10. It's loud. It's local. And no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. I was just talking with our last guest about problems and how we address problems on this program. And there are many. War, the distribution of income, worker safety, any number of issues we talk about on this program. That's what it's set up for. But we're going to talk to a guest now that may not see these particularly as problems so much as symptoms. And I'll let him, of course, decide whether that's the case or not. Our guest has been on the show before. He's Derek Jensen. He, the last time we spoke with him, we were talking about his book, Strangely Like War, about clear cutting. Also, he has a book out, Welcome to the Machine, about surveillance. One about education, Walking on Water, Reading, Writing, and Revolution. And perhaps maybe his most famous one, A Language Older Than Words. And Derek Jensen is an activist, small farmer, teacher, and philosopher, and we're talking to him in Northern California. Derek Jensen, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, the first question, we were talking about what the first question would be, and we are pretty wide-ranging here because your new book, your brand-new book, and it is huge to the point where it took up two volumes, Endgame, two volumes. The first one is The Problem of Civilization. The second one is Resistance. It's published by Seven Stories Press and probably totals about 1,000 pages. So what about the problem of civilization? Are we just dealing when we are opposing the war and the like? Is this just dealing with symptoms?
Yeah, there was a great book that really informed my thinking several years ago by Robert J. Lifton called The Nazi Doctors. And in that book, he asked the question, how is it that someone could, take the Hippocratic Oath and then go to work in a death camp or a concentration camp? And what he found, and he's not really talking so much about Mengele as he is just sort of the mainstream doctors there, and what he found is that many of the doctors who worked in the concentration camps actually did everything they could to help the Jews and other inmates, everything except for question the larger Auschwitz mentality. So they would give them an aspirin to lick if they were sick, or they would hide them from selections, or they would give them a day or two off work, but they wouldn't question working them to death. They wouldn't question starving them to death. They wouldn't question gassing them. And a lot of times I see the same thing among so many of us, whether we're working on issues of men's violence against women or environmental issues or anti-war issues or issues of race is that we do everything we can, if environmentalists, for example, we do everything we can to protect some piece of ground without questioning the larger death camp mentality that is really that's killing the whole planet. And or we, you know, if we're working on labor issues, we do everything we can except for question the larger sort of industrial capitalist mentality that you know, the logic of which leads inevitably to, you know, just these waste areas and to the, you know, grotesque exploitation of workers, as people in Detroit might know a little bit about.
Sure. Well, you mentioned in your book, I was just trying to look for it, it's voluminous, and in fact, too voluminous, that is TWO, and I was looking for the section on denial. One of the reasons, of course, that people are in denial is they can't face the fact of what they're trying to deny. And it's one thing to be able to say, let's get some social justice or economic justice in the labor market. Let's try to save this little piece of land. Let's try to stop a war based on lies. But to indict, and tell me if I'm in fact reading you correctly in Endgame, in particularly in Volume 1, where you talk about the problem of civilization, if it goes right to the very root of our social existence, that's a little difficult to confront.
Yeah. There's two. Well, which would you like me to address, civilization or denial first?
Your choice.
Okay. Well, I guess let's go with civilization first. I'm gonna lay out a pattern here, and they say that pattern recognition is one of the signs of intelligence, and I'll lay it out, and we'll see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And that's when you see the sort of the hills. When you think of the hills and plains of Iraq, is the first thing that you normally think about. Cedar forests that are so thick that sunlight never reaches the ground?
No, of course not.
I mean, the first written myth of this culture is that Gilgamesh went in and leveled the forests of what's now Iraq to make cities. And then Saudi Arabia was oak forest. And the Near East, you know, we've all heard about the cedars of Lebanon. They still have one on their flag. And Africa, I mean, Greece was heavily forested, and Plato, I think it was, it might have been Aristotle, but one of those two, was complaining that deforestation of Greece was destroying water quality. And, of course, those in power probably said, we need to study this for a little bit longer. And North Africa was forested. And this culture, I mean, forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. So that's, and then I want to say one more thing about civilization, which is I've been bashing civilization for probably, I don't know, 10, 15 years now, and with this book I decided I'd probably better define it. And civilization I've defined as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities, and that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And this is going to have a current point, don't worry. And the next thing is, okay, that's fine, Derek, but what's a city? And a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And the point is that two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of life can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And for example, I live now I'm not saying this is a human problem. I live on Talawa land, Talawa Indians. And, they lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talawa, they lived here forever. I mean, since the beginning of time. And they did that without destroying the land base. They ate salmon, huckleberry, clams. You know, whatever the land would give them willingly, they didn't require the importation of resources. And as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. I was doing a talk in Massachusetts a couple of years ago, and somebody was saying, you know, there's more forest now in Massachusetts than there was, you know, 100 years ago, which means we're living more sustainably. I said, no, it's because you're getting your wood from South America. You know, it's just increasing the reach of what's being consumed in order to make that city grow. And the other thing it means, having to do with war here, is that if you require the importation of resources, it means that your way of life must be based on violence, because trade will never be sufficiently reliable. If the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for that resource that you need, not just want, but need, if they won't trade you for it, you're going to take it. And so what this means is we could all become, you know, the most kind, wonderful people in the world, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to steal the oil that they need to run their economy.
Derek Jensen, talk a little, if you would, more about cities, because I was so struck, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, Mike Davis's essay, Planet of Slums, and almost the whole idea of this about 80-page essay is contained in the title. But more and more people leave the land as agriculture, particularly convivial agriculture, is destroyed and are flooding into these cities. I mean, I was recently in Caracas, and they said the city has between 3 and 5 million people. I mean, so they don't even know. There's so many people leaving the land. And so these little towns have become these metropolises or megapolises, actually, bigger than Detroit, which is under a million now. So cities are beginning, and slum cities are beginning to dominate the planet.
Well, two things about that is, one is I'm wondering, of those people who are leaving the land, I'm wondering if that's a bit of a euphemism, because I'm wondering if it might be more accurate to say that their land is being stolen.
They're being forced off it by economics, particularly NAFTA, what have you. So,
exactly. I mean, it's like the whole big deal right now with immigration. You know, they want to close the border to Mexico or not close it or whatever. And, I mean, I have sort of a tongue-in-cheek suggestion, which is actually kind of real, which is I always say that I'm actually in favor of closing the border to Mexico, for example, to the movement of people on one condition, which is you also close it to the movement of resources. Because if you want to close it to people but not resources, one of the things you're saying is that you're racist. And the other thing is that you're saying is that I don't want you, but I want the coffee that's grown on land that used to be yours. Because one of the big reasons that the people come up, it's not because they want to take an eco-tour of the San Joaquin Valley. They come up because their land has been stolen, their community has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm. And actually, they're the most industrious of our fellow workers. Something
Absolutely.
We're supposed to admire. My guest is Derek Jensen. He's the author of the brand new 2-volume Endgame. And the first volume is The Problem of Civilization, is what we're talking about. And fortunately, there's a second volume called Resistance, so we don't all get totally depressed. Or should we? I mean, the scope of human reach and destruction of the planet and its web of life is pretty serious. Some people have said we're beyond the point of no return.
Well, it depends. I mean, certainly for passenger pigeons, it's beyond the point of no return. For Eskimo curlews, for great auks, for many. But for others, it's not too late for the salmon. Salmon, for example, need five things in order to survive. There are six things, I'm sorry. They need for dams to be removed. They need for for industrial logging to stop, industrial fishing to stop, industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for the oceans not to be murdered. And they need for global warming to stop, which means that they need for the industrial economy to stop. We go, oh, my gosh, that's not possible. But it's only not possible if you accept this culture and its economic system as a given. And that's insane, because what is a given is the land base, because without a land base, you don't have anything. You can't destroy a planet and live on it, too. We've got this, I guess what Whitehead would call the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, and what any normal person would just call insanity, where people believe that the economic system is more important than the land. And that's, yes, on one level, we have been roped into this system in which we rely for our food and our water on the very system that's exploiting us, and that's killing the planet. But that doesn't alter the fact that the ultimate source of life is the planet itself. And we need to have our seriousness called into question, because this isn't some video game that we can just turn off and then turn back on, you know, and restart, you know, from a little bit before and this time do it right. And this isn't, I mean, we're talking about the murder of the planet. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And the phytoplankton populations are collapsing. When you mess with the phytoplankton populations, it's all over. You know, it's not just out there. I mean, there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk. When I do talks, I ask people, how many people have had someone you love die of cancer? About 80% say yes.
Hmm.
And of course, cancer is a disease of civilization increasing with the total toxification of the entire environment. The USGS says that every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens, which shouldn't surprise us since, once again, there's flame retardant and dioxin in every mother's breast milk. And the point is that, you know, at what point are we going to start, and this is where denial comes back in, at what point are we going to start resisting this? You know, does it have to just kill polar bears? Does it have to kill salmon? It's like, give me a threshold. What if you murder the oceans? What if it, okay, so maybe that's not good enough. What about if it takes out, your sister? What if it takes out your mother? What if my grandfather died of cancer? I have Crohn's disease, which is a disease of civilization. And, you know, it's eating away my guts, literally. That's what this disease does. And, you know, how close does it have to get before we start to resist? And there's one thing I'll say real fast, which is that one of the smartest things the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. In that, you want to get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? I think I'll get an ID card. Want to move to a ghetto? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get on a cattle car? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. And, of course, that step-by-step movement led them straight to the gas chambers. But I'll tell you something really important, which is the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. And my point is that we need to keep that in mind. And at what point are we going to start to resist this system that is, on the biggest scale, killing the planet, on the smallest scale, killing us? And also, I mean, I had this habit a long time ago of asking people if they like their jobs. About 90% say no. So the system isn't even making us happy. Most people are spending the majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do anyway.
Well, it's mostly not being able to even visualize an alternative, right. Let alone if you had a vision or you had the ideal in your mind, and then maybe you couldn't figure out how to get there. But a utopia doesn't seem possible, which would be the garden that we all came from once long ago.
Right. Yeah, and that's something I actually sort of get dinged for sometimes is, you know, people saying, gosh, Derek, you're talking about taking down the system, but you don't really provide alternatives. And there's a couple things about that. One is that, you know, there have been plenty of alternatives, and what happens when the dominant culture finds resources on the land belonging to those alternatives, whether they're the Talawa or, you know, the Shawnee or any indigenous peoples, or even like eco-village. You know, we set up this wonderful little eco-village. There's two things to say about setting up this groovy eco-village. One of them is that what happens if those in power find resources beneath, or what if they want that land for a Walmart? We all know what happens to that eco-village. And the other thing about that, or all I have to say is the words move in Philadelphia in terms of alternatives and what happens to them. And then the other part is that that at this point the whole system is so large that we can't simply set up some little enclave and hope that it survives the collapse of the world, because the global system is destroying everything and no place is safe. And how that relates. So another way to say all this is that, yeah, I think that there have been alternatives, and there will be alternatives once the system is gone. But right now, the system is thrashing around killing everything, and it's like wondering how we're going to live tomorrow as this sort of, you know, axe murderer stands over us right now, you know, tonight, and then, you know, turning to your partner and saying, so, darling, what do you want to do next week? How are we going to live next week? When the truth is, there's this system right now that's thrashing around killing everything.
Well, Derek Jensen, a couple things occur to me. I always try to intuit, which I don't know how good a job I do, of what listeners are thinking. First, they may be thinking, this guy's Chicken Little on a grand scale. Sure, there's problems. You know, there are problems with the fisheries. As you say, there is an increasing threat to species and numerous other things. There is an epidemic of cancer, and in a way, it's a trade-off. I mean, sure, but if only thing that Derek Jensen is suggesting is that we go back to native people, pre-technological people, I guess I'd rather risk cancer than live in a teepee. You've heard it before, I'm sure.
Right. And one of the things I have to say is that the least we can do, if we're going to kill the planet, the least we can do is be honest with ourselves. And any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. It, by definition, won't last, because eventually you're going to run out. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about, you know, donuts in a donut box, if you've got 12 of them, or, well, to take a random example, oil. You know, what are you going to do when the oil runs out? This current system is not going to last, and that's fine. If people don't want to, I mean, it seems it would be smart, at least a little bit smart, to start thinking about what we're going to do when there isn't oil to support this system. And what are we going to do? And so I would suggest that what people can do, I mean, some people get really, really upset at me because I'm talking about, you know, bringing down this system that's killing the planet, but I say, okay, great. If you don't want to participate in that, what's really important then is recognizing that the system isn't going to last and start making neighborhood gardens, start helping people, preparing people for that particular crash so that they can have a better chance of surviving through it. Like right now, today, I mean, as we're speaking, there's a rally going on in South Central LA for this wonderful farm that's been put up on in the middle of the city by the people themselves. And it's been there for, gosh, I think 15, 20 years or longer. And this developer, through these, you know, standard political deals, this developer wants to destroy it, you know, with the connivance of the mayor and the police and everybody else. And I think they were given an eviction order yesterday, and the cops are probably going to start moving in to kick them all out very soon. It's like, so there's plenty of stuff. I'm not simply saying, oh, yes, let's bring it down, that's all. There's a lot of really important resistance and community building work that can be done, too, that's good in any case. I mean, this farm is a good thing. Would you rather have this farm in South Central LA, or would you rather have a big warehouse for Walmart, which is exactly what he wants to do with it?
Let me reintroduce you since we're heading towards the end of our show. Our guest is Derek Jensen. He's just issued, actually, Seven Stories Press has. You can go to sevenstoriespress.com, I believe. Yeah. And I'm sorry, just sevenstories.com. Derek's website is derekjensen.org. It's D-E-R-R-I-C-K. J-E-N-S-E-N. And the book is Endgame. It's two volumes. The first one is The Problem of Civilization. The second one is Resistance. I mean, it sounds that when you talk about people, it's not like being a communist or something like that, that we want to bring down the current system and put in another one. The system is in the process, I believe you're arguing in your first volume, is collapsing of its own weight. It's what are we going to do recognizing this? And that gets to the second volume, which is Resistance. So there is some resistance when people begin to, when the power structure begins to attack people's at least small efforts to be self-sustainable, like you just related. What else do you see as resistance?
You know, I'm a big what's the opposite of proponent? Opponent, I guess. I don't like the whole reform versus revolution question at all. I think it's a bogus question because, excuse me. I'll start that over since I coughed.
Well, I was going to say you've got probably the same pollen in your throat that I do.
Yeah.
I've just been eating a lot of cough drops. But go ahead, Derek Jensen.
Okay. One of the wonderful things about everything being so messed up is that no matter where you look, there's really great work to be done. And I don't I think that a lot of reform work is really, really important as well. And the place I learned that was when I used to teach at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a supermax here in Northern California. And I recognized when I was walking in, I used to teach creative writing, I recognized when I walked in that I'm participating in the biggest racist gulag on the planet. But at the same time, I was told by many of my students that my classes were the only things keeping them sane. And so at that moment, the whole reform versus revolution question fell apart for me. And so resistance can take whatever forms. I mean, a phrase I've been thinking about a lot lately is, find what you love and defend your beloved.
Hmm.
So it's whatever issues are really important to you. If you feel very strongly about men's violence against women, do something. You know, go work at a battered women's shelter, volunteer at a rape crisis hotline. If what you really care about is wetlands, go do something to protect wetlands. If what you feel strongly about is the exploitation of labor, then work on that issue. There's tremendous work to be done, no matter where. And if what you care about is education, if what you care about is children, then work on issues associated with them. The important thing, really, and this is kind of a cliche, but it's so true, is to just start doing something. You know, I'll do talks, and a lot of times at my talks, I'll be, you know, gosh, 600, 800 people out in the West, in the Midwest, they're a little bit smaller, maybe a couple, 300. And, you know, everybody's all excited. Yeah, we need to bring down civilization. It's like, okay, so how many of you have ever actually filed a timber sale appeal, which is a purely, you know, it's a purely legal mechanism? And two of us, maybe one, me and one other person, raise our hands. How many people have done anything for battered women? You know, five people raise their hands. And out of 800 people, there's only, you know, maybe 50 people have done anything. And it's like, gosh, you know, start somewhere, do something. And that's one thing I was going to say. And another thing I was going to say is there's this wonderful question that somebody, Carolyn Raffensperger, asked me years ago, which is, What are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the world? So you obviously have, you, Peter, obviously have a gift for interviewing, and that's one of the ways that you can help. And I believe I have a gift for writing. That's one of the ways I can help. And I know people who bring in stray cats and take them to the vet to get them spayed. And I mean, that's something that somebody can do too. I mean, the problems are huge, but we can start somewhere. And whatever your gifts are, I mean, use those gifts in the service of your community.
Yeah, it is. I have friends that insist it's all hopeless. We're all circling the drain as a species, and the whole web of life is beginning to fall apart, which it is. But one of the things, somewhere back there, you indicated that something that rather going into panic mode is that we should do things that help ourselves, help our communities, help the planet, that also is enjoyable, that gives us gratification. I mean, it doesn't always have to be fun and games, but I meant that even if it's that more than cliched phrase about changing deck chairs rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, if it's gone too far, like some people insist, at least we will have connected up with a resistance, and we can say, I tried. I mean, that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario, of course, is that we succeed. Hey, you know what? I could talk to you for another 2 hours, and we're playing out of time. Derek Jensen has been our guest. I would highly recommend this two-volume work called Endgame, and it has a dire title. We should be facing the fact that we are facing dire circumstances. The first volume lays out the problem of civilization. The second one, it gives us something to hope for. It's called Resistance. It's published by Seven Stories Press, and you can go to sevenstories.com, or you can go to Derek's website, derekjensen.org. I also have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Some of you may remember the interview I did with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, author of Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie. She says, Derek Jensen's meditation on the state of the human and other species opens windows in the mind to thinking about familiar problems in new and hopeful ways, calling for urgent action. A good summation. Derek Jensen, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you for having
me. You're listening to WRIF.com.
presented by Molson.org and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Set it up. I think I'm